everybody. We are live. Actually, not only on time, but like 30 seconds early.
It's a miracle.
I don't even know like what to do now. I mean, we should just like, you know, kill some time for 30 seconds, I guess. I mean, I know how to kill a lot of time if you want to play some music.
Yeah,
there's nothing you can play the last 30 seconds.
I could. What about the seventh inning stretch on the Jim Blossoms album?
No, you can play. What's
only
that
12
thing doing here?
Marco, let me ask you a genuine question. What is an album that has come out in the last couple of years that you've really enjoyed that is not Phish?
I have really gotten into Goose a lot recently. Although this is
the aforementioned Goose.
Yes,
yeah, isn't that just Phish by another name?
No, it's a different band. I mean, look, it's like is all music from a certain genre the same band? No. Like there are more than one. There's more than one band in the jam band genre.
Can you do an analogy for us? Can you do like Phish is to Goose as U2 is to Coldplay?
No, but those bands both suck. Like that's
it's an analogy.
Please email Marco. Do not email the show feedback.
No,
please email Marco
right.
directly.
One of those bands.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Do you think that analogy holds? Because Coldplay is very U2-ish, but not as good as U2. So is Goose very Phish-ish, but not? Do you know how analogies work? This is what happens. If you take the analogies out of the SATs, kids don't understand them anymore. That's what happens, people.
Yeah. I mean, so yes, Goose, it's in the same genre as Phish, I would say. But I wouldn't say it's worse. It's definitely, it's a little bit different. It's like, you know, these aren't totally overlapping circles. They're just heavily overlapping circles. But it's not, you know, it's not like a clone. It isn't doing the exact same style. You know, it's in the same way, you know, you have multiple rock bands that played, you know, rock music that are not the same band and don't have the same sound. So anyway.
And so Goose, there is a new album in the last several years that you've enjoyed, like an actual studio album?
They have a studio album.
So you're just listening to live stuff, aren't you?
Yes.
There it is. Okay, are there any studio albums that you have discovered, whatever, in the last handful of years? I'm not looking to be particularly specific about this, that you have enjoyed.
Oh, man. Give me a second. I'm going to look through my recently added section of my Apple Music to see, like, which of these are actually, like, albums. What is all of this? Did I add some kind of playlist?
This drives me nuts about Apple Music. So
what is all this crap?
So I am slowly, as I've said many times in the past, I'm slowly beating myself into submission about Apple Music. Yikes. and still trying to divorce myself from Spotify. It's not working.
Where did my fish go?
All right. So here's the thing. When I transferred or whatever, I forget what service. No, it was an app that I used. I forget which one it was now. But I used an app to suck the handful of playlists that I really, really love from Spotify into Apple Music, which did work and worked reasonably well. But when you create a playlist in Apple Music, and this drives me bananas, what it does is it adds all of the stuff in that playlist into your library. Peer with all of the music you got when you were in college and Napster was a thing. Peer with all the music you've ripped from CDs. It's all peer. It's all the same. And I don't like that at all. If I want to add something in my library, I'll put it in my damn library. I don't want Apple Music to take a playlist and suck all that into my library. I do not want.
In the last couple days, I went through and I deleted a bunch of old like playlists and smart playlists from iTunes/music app on the Mac that I just hadn't used anymore. Cause you know, every time I wanted to like add a song to a playlist, that list was so long that I'm like, you know, let me just clean this up a little bit. And I guess somehow by doing that, I somehow triggered everything on the recently added list. This is stuff I've mostly never seen before. And I've never even heard of most of these bands, but somehow I got a whole bunch of stuff added to this list.
What is the recently added? Are you looking at this on your phone or on your Mac? That's the first question.
Both. So in the phone music app, like if you go to that default tab under library, if you scroll down on the library tab and you get the recently added, that's usually how I listen to all my Phish and Goose and stuff, because usually I'm listening to recent concerts that have been released. So that's like my main home of listening. And now there's all these things from like, you know, these bands like, you know, I don't know who Bill Withers is. I assume this is not pronounced management.
Gosh.
MGMT. I know what Tycho is, but it's not. None of these are in my library before, and now I have this giant list of all this stuff of bands I've never added to my library.
And you don't know how that happened?
No, no idea. I'll see what happens if I delete it. But
no, I just look at that section on my phone and I recognize all the things that it shows recently added because they're things I recently added.
I can't. I have no idea what this is. Like these aren't stations I've played on the HomePod or anything. Like it's
Mac Music has it too. I see the same thing. I'm underneath the library recently added. Okay.
So John, while Marco
is there, it is. All right, I deleted all that crap and I got my own recents back. So now I can tell you. Let's see. Fish, goose, fish.
I was gonna make a duck, duck, goose joke earlier, but I think you kind of beat me to it.
Thriller. That's a while ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an old album, but it's a great album.
It is, yeah. It's a while ago. Distant Thunderstorms. Yeah, I'm not finding... This is all, top four stuff. I don't know what... So, the problem is that the style of music that I usually like, first of all, is jam band music that is mostly concert-based. So, while they do tend to release albums periodically, they tend not to be what I'm looking for, best of that band. And so,
as a Dave Matthews Band fan, I know what you're saying. I understand.
Right. So anyway, that's most of my music listening is jam bands. And then secondly, from that, there are other bands and genres I like, but they tend to be bands that are from like the 90s or early 2000s. And some of them are still making albums. Most of them are not. Or if they do make a new album, it's not recent. So, like, for instance, like Stroke Nine is one of my favorite bands. I love Stroke Nine. They are still making music, not super frequently, and usually it's released as just like singles on Bandcamp instead of a full album. They did make a full album a couple years ago, and I do like it. But that might even be too old now for it to qualify. I forget when that came out, but so that's one example is the new Stroke Nine album. But again, that's not super recent.
I mean, I don't care if it's an old band as long as they're releasing new music, and it sounds like Stroke Nine is the only one you can come up with, which that's fine.
There are lots of those bands that released albums like well into the modern day or like at least like the mid 2000s. Like, like the Spin Doctors released an album in like 2008 or 10 or something, and it's not bad. Like, there's lots of the Meat Puppets, I think, are still releasing albums on a regular basis. There's lots of those bands. I mean, Weezer can't stop crapping out mediocre music. They're still going, and
please email Marco, not the show, Marco.
some of the modern Weezer albums are decent, like the one with the monster on the front.
I'm actually not a particularly big Weezer fan at all, to be honest with you, but I'm not spitting out hot takes, well, until just now. Real-time follow-up while I have the floor. Yodalogical says that you can disable this feature that I dislike so, at least on the Mac Music app. You go into Settings, hit the Advanced tab, and there's a checkbox, Add Songs to Library when adding to Playlists. I had already had that unchecked, but a lot of these playlists were created, like I said, using some app on my iPhone, so I don't know what the situation is there, but that is good to know, and I will keep an eye on that in the future. So
I looked up the one Weezer album I said that was recent and good. It's called Everything Will Be All Right in the End. It's 8 years old. That feels great. I love the Avett Brothers. That was like a fairly modern find, but even that's like, 2008, and they're still making music, but I like their older stuff better. There's all sorts of bands like that. So I do listen to other stuff, but not a ton of it and not super recently. And part of that also is because the type of music that I like outside of jam bands is not really made anymore by very many bands. Like, I like rock music. Rock does not really exist anymore the way we knew it. 20, 30 years ago, there are still some bands making some music that kind of sounds like rock, but they're few and far between. And what is now popular, all the genres now that are popular, really are pretty far from that kind of sound. So what I'm looking for, as everyone, is the music that was the style when I was a teenager / young adult, and that's pretty hard to come by.
John, are there any albums that you've discovered recently that are of the last few years that you would like to pitch or plug?
Hearing Marco talk about all these bands, these old bands that are still around and making music, Meat Puppets. Anyway, I figured it was my turn to try to make you two feel old if you would like to look in the Slack at the picture I posted there.
I have no idea who this man is. So I'm looking
at kind of like a high school principal, maybe.
Yeah. So it's a mostly bald man. He has like the Captain Picard, you know, rim around the back of the head with a very serious, almost walrus level mustache. And he's looking to the right hand side of the photograph, to his left, and his mouth is agape, and it looks like he's in the midst of talking.
And it's hard for me to gauge, for people who are born when you two were born, if this is the correct timing to make you feel old. But anyway, last chance. Any guesses? Who is this?
Oh, I have no earthly idea.
Is that like some formerly cool young musician who's now not cool and old?
Yeah. Who is it?
Oh man, is that like the lead singer of Meat Puppets or something?
Oh, here you go. Here you go. It's the guy on the right. And if you don't know who these people is, so help me, Marco. I will reach through this computer line.
Mother of God, are you serious? I don't know his name, but I know that this is...
Don't give it. Okay. Marco, do you know what is pictured in the bottom photo?
I'm going to take a wild guess. I don't know for sure. I'm going to guess, is this Oasis?
Oh, my God.
No,
oh
it's not. I guess I got that one wrong.
Oh, no. Oh, Marco. I know in Marco.
Oh, my God.
I cannot state this fellow's
name. And the reason I paused there is like, you never know with Marco. It's always worth asking. Always. I'm going to put in a photo of the Statue of Liberty and be like, Marco, do you know what this is? And you'll be like, is that Oasis? Listeners, maybe Mark will put in the show notes. Casey, what if I pasted into the chat room? What if I pasted here?
So again, the first picture was the old high school principal, bald mustache, walrus mustache. The bottom picture is the band Nirvana with Dave Grohl.
You may be familiar with them. They're obscure. You might not have heard of them. I don't know.
I never knew Dave Grohl. Hair was that short at any point.
They're leaving like an RV or a trailer or whatnot. It's Dave Grohl on the left, Kurt Cobain in the center.
How do you not recognize Dave Grohl? You like the Foo Fighters.
Yeah, he plays like 10.
That's the whole point of this.
Also, his hair is too short. None of the one guy in the picture with long hair is the guy you're asking about, who I don't know. The Dave Grohl and Kurt Cobain always had much longer hair than that when I, like, knew of
this. This is a photo of the entire band Nirvana when they were popular and you thought it was Oasis. So you're not coming back from this. I'm sorry. Just
I mean, I got the time period almost right.
But anyway, does that make you feel old? I guess not, because you don't even know who the heck they are. But
it makes me feel really freaking old. My goodness.
I can tell you which of the songs are Meat Puppet songs.
Oh, my gosh. can we also agree, this is tangentially related, that Dave Grohl is possibly the coolest and most awesome human that has ever existed?
I love him. He makes me so happy. Like, he's... Like, as far as, okay, so first of all, with the disclaimer, as far as we know, he's not, like, a jerk in any major ways, so that helps a lot, but, like, he just puts out so much good music and so much good energy into the music world, like, he just seems like, he's one of those pure musicians who just wants to rock all the time, and not to mention the fact that he is incredibly talented at doing so, I have a lot of respect for him.
Did I photograph them playing at WWDC? Am I imagining that, or was that a different band?
No, Foo Fighters never played when we were there.
Who played WWDC?
Weezer played one of ours. It was a terrible gig. I can't nothing against them. I mean, they haven't ever been known for putting on a great show, but this was also like the world's most horrible gig for a band to play. You're playing it with the backs of a bunch of nerds who were trying to stay as far away from you as possible so they could talk to each other.
Let's see if I can find in my photos who that.
There was Vampire Weekend. There was a bunch of I shouldn't say no-name bands, just bands that I was not particularly familiar with. I'm just trying to think of the ones that I recognized and was aware of.
I have too many WWDC pictures.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a list somewhere, but that's all right. But yeah, for those, just while you're to stall for time, I really enjoyed the new-ish Muse album. Speaking of rock music, Will of the People, Silver Sun Pickups just came out with a new-ish album, Physical Thrills, which is very good. I also really enjoyed particularly the first few songs of Halsey's If I Can't Have Love, I Want Power. Very, very good album. Really enjoyed all those. And those are all in the last year or two, if I recall correctly. So
just put a picture in the chat room.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's
the giant W symbol kind of gives that one away.
I don't know why I thought it was the Foo Fighters. It was a couple of years ago, yeah.
That was the last time we were all together, wasn't it? Oh, sad.
Maybe.
It was the last time I think I saw you, chuckleheads. Because, you know, 2020 was all over. The world ended. Yeah. Sad. All right. We should probably do a show for anyone that's actually still listening. I think we might have driven, if this might be the time, this might be the episode that we've driven everyone off. So for the three of you that are still here, thank you for hanging out with us. Let's drive you off too and talk about healthcare in the United States. Woo! So a handful of people pointed us to, I feel like I've heard of this fellow, although I don't know any of his work, and that's not, I'm not trying to be funny. I'm really serious. Brian David Gilbert, who apparently is pretty popular on YouTube, did an overview of US healthcare terminology, which covers, a lot of terminology. And because it's the US government, a lot of acronyms. This was very interesting. I had pieced together over time almost everything that he talked about, so I was pretty proud of myself. But there's definitely stuff in this that I didn't know. And if you live in a civilized country and want to see how barbaric and ridiculous our setup is, this is the video for you, because it is entertaining, but it is not the video, but our healthcare system is a mess. So
yeah, it's not aimed at like explaining the healthcare system. It's aimed at like, because he made a video, he's making lemons on lemonade. He like either lost his job or left his job and he was out on his own and needed to deal with healthcare, not through, you know, his employer or, you know, continuing his healthcare from his employer. And so he had to do a crash course and like, I've never had to do this before. I've got to learn about it. And so as part of the process of learning about it, he made a video, because that's what you do if you're a YouTuber, you know, and it makes perfect sense. And so that's what it's about. It's, you know, it's kind of like if you're just leaving school or just going off your parents' healthcare and you don't know how the system works in the US, this video is for you. But he also put in a little section. I mean, you do learn a lot about the US healthcare section. He put in a little bit in the beginning that says, and I'm quoting from the video, "And for those of you non-Americans watching this video thinking, I don't need to watch this video, I'm British, consider it a cautionary tale, because there are definitely people in your country that want to privatize healthcare, and you can't let them do that." And then he emphasizes, you can't let them do that, because it's terrible if you become like us.
The best part of this, by the way, was that he was wearing he had you know, kind of like dubbed, if you will.
Don't ruin the joke.
All right.
Let people watch it. It's humor.
Well, you should watch it for the visual gag as well. But yeah, it's
my favorite term,
it's
by the way, is coinsurance. This, it's one of those things where it's like, it sounds like a good thing. Oh, I get 80% coinsurance? What's that? And then you learn, depending on what side of the line it's on, it's like, oh, that means I pay either 20% or 80%.
Or more likely 80%.
The entire cost of whatever, you know, operation I would get in that scenario or whatever. It's like, oh, that's not super useful after all. Yeah, we have all sorts of fun stuff. Ugh. And my favorite feedback from people on our healthcare thing was, why don't you just move to insert better country here?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, that's easier said than done for most people. Like I think most people, the suggestion of why don't you just move across the world to a different country might not be super helpful.
I mean, especially when it's phrased that way, I feel like that's the type of thing where if I was in a snarky move, I would be like, what's your best guess? You know, which is when here's my answer is like, why don't you just move to a different country? It's like, I don't know. Like, what do you think? What are possible answers to that question? Why someone wouldn't want to move to another country? Let's write them on the board, class.
I mean, cost. You know,
I bet if we put our heads together, we can come up with some kind of, why would someone not want to leave the country? Yeah. Right. It's hard. Exactly.
Turns out, first of all,
other countries aren't all necessarily saying, sure, come live here. Yeah. You can live here permanently forever really easily. I mean, granted, not all of them are as bad as the U.S. in that regard, but some of them are, you know, whatever. But yeah, all the other stuff, like our family's here, it's expensive, we have a house, kids are in school, like all the reasons you would expect. So to answer that question, but that's not really what they're asking. What they're really saying is, we have it better here, and if you came here, you'd be happier. And they're probably right, but it's still a big ask, as they say.
Or at least, like, it might be better in that way, but there also might be other changes that we would not view as better, you know?
Not being able to speak the language would be difficult for a lot of the countries, but the countries that do speak English, pretty much everything is better.
Like Australian? Man, I had no chance understanding anything they say.
I don't know if you're kidding, but I'm not when I say I think you're right, because Australians abbreviate everything.
Oh, you'd be fine. You'd be fine, terrible, and it would be fun.
Is Australian internet access still terrible? Is it still really slow?
No, I think it's gotten better.
I think it's at least mediocre, but it's way, way, way cheaper, which is, you know, an improvement. We had a couple of Canadians write us, and here's the thing. I like seasons. I like to have a season other than winter, please and thank you.
Yeah,
so,
if I'm only going to have one season, that's the last one I would pick.
Right? Now, this is when you're all firing up your emails.
Yeah,
I know there are other seasons.
That bad.
I'm kidding, mostly. But I just like Fahrenheit too much, and that's why I won't move. Anyway, John, tell me.
Canadian emails, they show up as only about 90% the size of ours.
Gosh, John, tell me about this Ars Technica article, please.
Oh yeah, just one more link for the people who want to learn more about it. The headline is, you know, you'd write this article every year for the past 100 years. It'd probably be true. U.S. still has the worst, most expensive healthcare of any high-income country. As a country, the U.S. spends more on healthcare than any other high-income country in the world on the basis of both per-person costs and share of gross domestic product. Compared with other high-income peers, the U.S. has the shortest life expectancy at birth, the highest rate of avoidable deaths, the highest rate of newborn deaths, the highest rate of maternal deaths, the highest rate of adults with chronic conditions. We pay the most, we get the worst. We're number one. Woo! U.S. healthcare.
USA! USA!
Yeah. And again, this is not a new thing. This has been true for our entire lives. The system sucks. We're trying to change it. We are stopped by many powerful forces and stupidity.
All right. It wouldn't be a new Apple product if we didn't have some sort of drama around it. We were talking about SSDs last week. Well, new HomePod review units are out. And guess what, baby? On the plus side, it does have a removable power cable. In fact, it comes removed in the box, apparently. But the white ring on wood tables, I don't even know what to call this, but the ring on tables thing is still a thing, apparently, at least at the beginning. MKBHD has a video, which we'll link in the show notes, where he discusses how the new HomePod does still indeed leave a different and lighter ring on wood surfaces, particularly the white one. But then I just saw a follow-up, maybe it was a reel on Instagram. I don't remember where I saw it, so I probably won't link it for the show notes. But he had said after the first like one or two placements, you know, he put it down on the on a table and then moved it once, then moved it again. And by like the third or fourth time, he said the ring doesn't seem to be coming back anymore. So his suggestion, I'm not sure how you would do this, but his suggestion was clean the bottom of your HomePod and see if that makes a difference before you stick it on untreated wooden tables.
Yeah, so this we had this discussion when the very first big HomePod came out. And in practice, it is the type of thing that basically resolved itself because either because people don't care that it was doing that or they found a place to put it where this wasn't an issue or it did it once it went away. This is not like the story here is not so much that, you know, this problem remains or something. The story is that the new HomePod is so unchanged from the old one, despite essentially having every single part be new, as far as I know. Like, it's not the same size, not the same shape. The foot on the bottom is not the same. The screen on the top's not the same. The insides aren't the same. It's like an all new HomePod. But as I talked about last time when we discussed the new HomePod, they didn't really rethink this product down to this little weird annoyance that, you know, wasn't a very big issue, but hey, if you're coming up with the new HomePod, shouldn't everything be on the table? We could do better the second time around. I guess it makes a lighter ring, you know, the second time around. The foot is differently shaped, but they didn't even reconsider, like, is there another way we can... Could the bottom of the HomePod be different in some way to totally avoid this issue? And they did not address that. They did not rethink that. They just basically did a slightly updated version of the same rubber foot they had before.
But now only 5 tweeters are pushing down to make the ring.
Yeah.
No, I'm... As far as the HomePod, I don't have mine yet. I think I'm going to have it for next week's show, but I don't have it yet. But I think I'm pretty encouraged by the reviews so far. The reviews basically say it sounds about the same, but is faster, and that's exactly what I wanted. That's exactly the low expectations version of this product. And I think again, I'm very happy that this update happened at all. There are so many things I would love to do differently with this product if they actually, you know, put more effort into like a real redesign and a real rethink of this product and maybe this product line. I would love to see them do more, and we all would. But I'm of the impression that, or at least I'm of the theory that, I don't think the discontinuation of the first HomePod was necessarily planned or happened on schedule or whatever. I suspect that was a product that they expected to last longer than it did, and they expected to sell better than it did. And then something changed in the COVID era where, you know, we were hearing that they were still selling out their launch stock. So maybe it's like at the end there. So maybe they just massively made way too many of them. it used an old processor on an old process node, and nothing else in the lineup at that time was still using anything as old as the A8, as far as I know. And so it's possible with all the chip shortages and stuff, they couldn't even get any more A8s if they wanted to make more. It's also possible that all the different things we were hearing about, like, you know, certain, you know, bad electronic parts or physical design flaws that would slowly fry certain components, maybe it would just cost them too much in repairs and they couldn't redesign it yet or whatever the case may be. I think that that product's lifespan was cut short. And so I think they probably at that time when they discontinued it, that's probably when they started making this one. And it took them this long to do it because, you know, Apple's Apple. But I don't think they actually really were stepping back and rethinking and redesigning this product. I think they were putting out fires from the first one, you know, just, you know, metaphorically speaking. I don't think it actually started fires as far as I know. but, you know, so they were trying to just fix whatever was causing them to not even be able to continue the product existing. They fixed those things and, you know, engineered this new one with whatever resources they were able to justify here. Because, again, this is probably not a high volume product at all. So they can't afford to, like, drop everything from their more important product lines and put a bunch of engineers on this and get a new version out there in 6 months. Like, I don't think that's a thing they could do here. They couldn't justify that kind of prioritization for this product. So they did what they could with the resources that whatever team did this was able to get from the company. And so this is a good, like, you know, HomePod 1.5 maybe, but if they ever do like a true 2.0, I would hope to see more changes, you know, for, and again, I don't have mine yet, so we'll see. But for instance, obviously some kind of input would be great. I don't think they're ever going to do it because that's not their way, but that would certainly be great for preserving the lifespan of these products, you know, to using them in the future. Look at how many people have iPod hi-fis still in use today because they have inputs and they're able to have this perfectly good working speaker, this perfectly good working powered speaker. Like, they're able to use it afterwards, after all of the technology is outdated, after the whole product line it was made to hold and work with, it doesn't even exist anymore. Long after that, people still can use iPod hi-fis today because it has a line input and it's just an AC powered speaker. And those things tend to last a long time when they don't have any major design flaws. So anyway, I would love for the HomePods to have that kind of versatility and you know, potential lifespan and future use. That would be great because they're really good speakers. I would also love them to rethink the control surface. I can't tell you how many times, if you've ever had a HomePod on a counter near a light switch, you have had this problem where at some point, you know, maybe it's on your kitchen counter. You walk by to flip the light switch off and you accidentally brush a finger against that touch surface. And maybe since you're turning the light off, maybe it's late at night and your house is quiet and people are already asleep. And because you suddenly brush that finger against that touch surface when you turn the light off, it instantly starts blasting your Foo Fighters that you were playing earlier to your quiet house. And just there's and of course that is not an option. Whatever action you tap the HomePod to resume playing whatever it was playing before, can't turn that off. So that's just it. Good luck ever dusting one. Same thing, same reason. But why would dust accumulate on a flat surface facing straight up? Anyway, so there's lots of, you know, little tweaks. The power cord, I'm glad it's removable, but I would prefer if it had a standard IEC power socket because then I could buy a shorter or longer one. Because right now, the power cords on every HomePod are way too long for where I think, at least I tend to place them, and I would venture a lot of people. Again, if you're putting them on a counter, say, or like, you know, a bathroom shelf or something, or somewhere, wherever, if you're putting the HomePod on a counter or a shelf, chances are the power cord it comes with has a pretty good chance of being way too long. And so right now, I have these like little 3D printed stands that I put them on, just these pieces of plastic that have basically like a coil of wire coiled up inside their base and a little hole coming out the back. So you can like coil up the excess wire in this base and then have them shoot at the back into the outlet.
You're messing with the acoustic performance. But
I am. And I wish I didn't have to. But otherwise, I have like 6 feet of excess cable because the HomePod, where it goes on the countertop, is literally like 5 inches from an outlet. So I need like a 5-inch long cable, but, you know, because it's a proprietary cable that's totally non-standard, I can't just, you know, buy a cable on Amazon that fits it. So again, these are things that I would change. Maybe have some kind of, as I mentioned before, some kind of battery version, whatever. I don't want to go too far into this, but because, you know, I don't even have mine yet. But basically, I think it's right to look at this product not as a 2.0, but as, like, at best a 1.5, because this was a, oh crap, something went wrong product. This was not intended to ever to be, like, this was not the plan from the beginning, I don't think. If you look at what happened, I can't imagine this was planned from the beginning to be this way. So let's judge this product for what it is, which is a revision to the previous HomePod, not a sequel.
I've watched a lot of the reviews, and I feel like they're kind of not encouraging to me. A lot of people say, oh, it sounds just as good, it's fine, like, you don't notice any of the missing stuff. But there are a bunch of ones, including ones that had people, like, blindfolded, so they didn't know what thing they were listening to, that were picking the old HomePod over the new one. And I didn't see a single one that was saying the new one sounds better than the old. So that's not particularly encouraging, but it'll probably be fine.
We'll see. It is very, very difficult. I talked about this before. It's very, very difficult to do fair, accurate, blind tests of audio equipment, because even the slightest difference in volume or the very slightest difference in, like, the EQ balance can make somebody think one sounds better than the other.
I know, but if that was the case, I would have expected to see somewhere where it went the other direction, somewhere the new one was preferred, and I didn't. I mean, I maybe watched, like, 7 reviews, so it's not a great sample size, but I'm just saying.
I've also, for whatever it's worth, I have found that whatever I am looking for in headphones or speakers oftentimes it does not line up with what tech reviewers are looking for when they review speakers and headphones. Like, there's been so many times where the tech world will just be fawning all over this, some new, you know, headphone or speaker or even microphone that comes out, and then I get it and try it and I do a direct comparison to other stuff and I'm like, I don't get it. Why is this special? Why is this good? This is not as good as they say it is to my ears. And, you know, at first, my original, you know, MO on that was basically to go on my blog and say everyone's wrong. And that's how I started my original beef with the wire cutter, where he insulted my genitals on Twitter. That was fun. So anyway, my new strategy here, or my new approach here, is just to assume I'm the weird one here. Because I know, look, people's tastes vary, and also people's tastes in audio products shifts over time. Like, your ears change over time, your preferences change over time, your taste changes over time. So all I can say is I often don't agree with what tech reviewers look for in audio gear. So and I would imagine that probably applies to lots of you out there. You also might not agree with them for different reasons in different directions, maybe. But it's very, very difficult to measure audio quality of something. It's very subjective, and then to try to communicate that in a review in a useful way is even more difficult. And then and then you reading or watching it, you really have no idea whether you would like this in your room, in your house, playing your music to your ears. So it's so difficult to make comparisons. So that's why you kind of just gotta, you know, you can take general ideas from people, like, hey, in general, this set of products over here is pretty good and is worthy of consideration, and maybe this set of products over here is not so good. But the specifics of, you know, small details. Hey, does this thing sound better than this thing? Well, kind of, sort of, maybe. It depends on what you want or what you're playing or whatever, your room. You know, there's so many little variations and little details that matter a lot that you can't make subtle distinctions very well in a repeatable, useful way.
You know, Marco, you can buy a third-party cable and connect it to your new HomePod.
You can? What
kind of looking at this 9to5 Mac story that was posted in the chat, and has a little caption on a picture that shows some ugly black third-party cable that says, plugged into a new HomePod, it says, you can use any figure-8 cable as a replacement. I don't know what the heck a figure-8 cable is, but it looks kind of like
on the back of the Apple TV and the most PlayStations.
Yeah, but it looks bigger than that. Maybe I can't tell from the picture.
No,
it's a similar
shape.
Exactly
like that. Yeah, that's one of the IEC cable types. I forget the name of it, but that's a standard cable.
Yeah, because I would imagine that, like, they wouldn't have come up with it, because to get a new cable, new connector type, like certified or whatever, blah, 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 would be kind of annoying and painful. And I was going to say it looked a lot like the one that's in the back of my PlayStation 5, but maybe bigger. But again, I can't tell scale from these photos, so maybe it is the exact same size.
Yeah, it looks like it's, and thanks to David Schaub in the chat, it's a C7 or C8 cable, depending on whether it's keyed or not, I believe. But that's, yeah, it's the same cable as, like, the Apple TV.
Depends on whether the engine
Mini
is in the front or in the mid. engine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Reference acknowledged.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. That makes me very happy. I can get rid of my plastic dumb things. I'm going to go order some short C7 cables right now.
This doesn't look
as
pretty.
You don't know
pretty,
if it's C7 or C8, though.
I don't care. I'll take the risk. They're cheap.
I'm just going to buy it. All right.
All right. John, can you figure out or perhaps tell Marco the answer to all of his USB charging woes, please?
We can try. We got a big authoritative answer from our friend of the show, Jonathan Dietz, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly because he's written in so many times. Here is quoting from his email. The short answer to Marco's question about why USB Type-C chargers don't work with the janky accessories is that they're non-compliant. There are, however, chargers that might work with these devices anyway. So that's quoting from him. And then he wrote a big, long email explaining all. It was way too long for me to put in the show, so I'm trying to summarize it. Forgive me if I'm getting any of this wrong. I did not run it past him, but here's my summary of what was in the email. All right, so here's the timeline. In the absence of relevant standards, Apple, Samsung, Qualcomm, and others came up with their own proprietary charging standards for multiple voltages and currents over USB cables. Like they just did what they felt like they were doing. Mostly involved series of resistors, and depending on the resistance, you'd get different voltage and amps and blah. They all came up with their own thing. Right? This is proprietary charging standards. They just did what they wanted. Right? Tons of manufacturers made chargers that work with these various proprietary systems, which makes sense. Once Apple, Samsung, and all these other companies do it, then people will just copy and say, okay, if you buy this, it will work with your, you know, thing, right? With the release of version 1.3 of the USB Type-C specification on July 14th, 2017, proprietary charging was deprecated. Apple promptly replaced all of its Type-C power bricks with new compliant models. So that, you know, it used to be these proprietary ones were sort of under the umbrella of the USB thing. But when they updated for Type-C spec, said, no. We have our own charging thing. This is what it is. All that old crap that you were doing before in the Wild West, that's out. And then the important part is that Apple said, okay, now from this point forward, we're not, all of our charging brick things that come are not going to support the old proprietary stuff. If you have a USB Type-C brick type thing, or a device that will charge from a Type-A charger but not a Type-C one, it's probably using a proprietary charging mode. If you can get your hands on an Apple 29-watt, 61-watt, 87-watt USB-C power adapter sold prior to the USB Type-C 1.3 spec changeover, that means one of those bricks that was sold before 2018, it might be a universal charger. So that's the answer. Why doesn't this thing work? Why can't they make one or whatever? The thing you have is probably use proprietary charging method, and you're probably trying to use a more modern Apple charging brick because you have modern stuff. So here, going back to Jonathan, his conclusion, Marco's issue has nothing to do with USB power delivery, as that specification doesn't even come into play here. It's related to buying non-certified, non-compliant crap made by people who are too lazy to copy a working USB Type-C design from some time in the past 5 years. So that's the solution. If you want to find something that will charge it, apparently if you can find one of those old Apple chargers before they remove support for quote-unquote proprietary charging, that will work.
Yeah, and apparently the root of the issue here is, you know obviously they were these old standards, as Jonathan Dietz said, and when they designed USB-C power delivery, keep in mind that power delivery, not only does it support a whole bunch of different voltages and levels of current across a pretty wide range and up to a very substantial amount of power, but it also supports powering things bidirectionally. Like the cable can't tell which end is the source without, you know, these protocols being followed that are more advanced than old dumb power. And so apparently there, you know, like you wouldn't want to have the cable just always pass power without knowing what it is, because it could be passing power in the wrong direction. And that could do things like start fires in the worst case scenario. So what you have is they have this basic method where, and forgive me if I'm getting the details wrong, but basically USB-C ports can optionally put like one resistor across two pins, and that will tell the cable, treat this like the old dumb charger thing. So if you have that one resistor in place, then a USB-C port can take power from any PD supply, and it'll just send it old 5-volt, you know, 2.4-amp or whatever power, just like, you know, just like all the old USB-A stuff. And so all these devices that we have that are coming out that have USB-C holes that do not charge from USB-C power bricks could have fixed that problem, apparently, with the addition of one resistor. and they just don't or didn't. For
that's what he's saying about janky, non-compliant stuff that didn't copy a working design from sometime in the past 5 years.
Yes. So now we know the reason. Unfortunately, that's not really a solution. And it sounds like there probably really can't be a good solution.
Well, what about the using the old Apple power bricks before they remove support for proprietary charging? Because that will work with your janky old crap, because those power bricks will, they can do PD, but they can also do all the old weird proprietary ones from Apple, Samsung, Qualcomm, because they were just in the before the standardization and before PD was sort of finalized, all the bricks supported all the weird proprietary stuff because they just wanted to be able to work. So if you can find one of those old bricks, it should work.
I think the process of trying to find an Apple power adapter that's from like before a certain manufacturing year that doesn't even have probably a separate SKU or anything, I don't think that process is going to be worth it. But
also here is another suggestion from Conrad Pose.
Yeah,
if that's how you pronounce his last name. My fix for dumb USB-C charge ports is to buy a cheap USB-A to USB-C adapter and attach it to the USB-A end of the charge cable. Then you have a C to A to C cable that will work with any USB-C charger, even though a C to C cable won't. I don't know if that would work, but it sounds like a fun dongle to try.
Yes. So, and a few people wrote in to basically say, because like you can get cheap dongles that not only do what we often had in the Apple world since 2016, which is take a USB-C port and be able to plug a USB-A device into it. But you also have little dongles that go the other direction. Take a USB-A port and make a USB-C port out of it to be able to plug in something with USB-C into a USB-A port. And so if you just stick two of these together, so it goes C to A to C, or you do the same thing with a cable, like what this person was writing and saying, it will basically make a directional USB-A like buffer thing so that it will work. The downside is that it will only obviously work in that one direction. So whatever this cable mess you're making with this dongle thing in the middle becomes directional, and that's fine for many cases. And also, it would be limited, if it follows all the specs, which I hope it does, it would be limited to only the lower wattages supported by USB-A charging. So that's not, honestly, that's not a bad idea. So I think I'm going to try that maybe just to like keep some of these in my travel bag in case I need them. But ultimately, many people wrote in to basically say, just have a charging brick that has A and C holes and have some A to C cables, which that's not the answer, but that is probably the only solution. Like that's not at all what I was asking for, but that is probably what I should do.
Fun times. All right, so we have some more reviews and things from the M2 Pro and the M2 Max, most especially from Max Tech. So, John, can you tell me about what is it, Vadim? Vadim? How do you pronounce his name? Do you know?
Vadim Yuryev, yeah. So the Max Tech folks always do tests on these things. I just wanted to have some concrete support for what we discussed on past episodes with the M2 Pro and Max products. They are exactly what they appeared to be. The silicon system on a chip is made on the same process node size as the predecessors. They're a little bit bigger. That results in systems that use a little bit more power. They get a little bit hotter, and the fans run at a little bit higher RPM, and that is all borne out by the testing. Not big amounts, because it is, you know, the M2 Pro and Max are a little bit bigger than the M1 Pro and Max. They have a little bit more stuff in them. They run at higher clock speeds. The fans go at higher RPMs, not ridiculously higher. Like, you know, the numerically, it does look higher, but the sound levels seem to be similar. But, you know, that's why I thought the M1 ones, they had so much overhead, but the M2 ones eat some of that overhead in exchange for having higher clocks, for getting better performance. Obviously, it's exactly what you thought it would be. So there's no real surprises in there. The cooling systems are similar in both machines. The temperatures are higher. So like Apple is pushing the innards of the new M2 Pro, M2 Max products harder than they were pushed in the M1 variants. They're clocked higher. They're allowed to get warmer. In the course of normal running, doesn't seem to be any excessive throttling any more than there was on the previous ones. But just FYI, those M2 products are just a little bit more than the M1 ones. So if you really, really care about being super silent and super, super cool, and you don't care about that 20% of performance,
I
buy an M1
cool.
Pro or an M1 Max.
Fair enough. And then tell me about their new ultra mega clock speeds.
Oh yeah, this is you know, just to put numbers on this. So the M2 Max was able to clock up to 3.68 gigahertz on the 16-inch MacBook Pro, and it got the highest score they've ever seen for a single core, breaking 2,000 on Geekbench. So yeah, for all of that extra noise and extra heat and all that, you know, for that tiny bit of extra heat, for that tiny bit of extra noise, for that tiny bit of extra clock speed and tiny bit of extra power, you get the highest scores they've ever seen. So if that's what you care about, then the M2 ones are the machines for you.
Marco, you have not ordered any M2 computers as yet?
I mean, I have the M2 MacBook Air from last summer, but But no, none of the M2 Pro and Max machines. I'm still so incredibly happy with my 16-inch. It's just wonderful. And you know, and while I do, you know, I know that Xcode is 25% faster with the new ones, and that is tempting. But and it's tempting every time I do a build, but I'm just so happy with this. I love that it runs a little bit cooler and quieter than the new ones. I think I still prefer that trade-off for now. So I think I'm going to skip this generation and maybe consider, you know, we'll see what happens with the M3 series of chips or whatever comes after that. We are scheduled for a process node shrink, probably with the M3 generation. So we'll see what happens there. Or we'll see, you know, we'll see if I'm still doing desktop laptop. You know, maybe the Mac Pro or whatever will tempt me, but probably not. So we'll see what happens. But no, I'm very happy with my M1, and I think anybody with an M1 Pro or Max MacBook Pro or Mac Studio or anything, I think you don't have much reason to be envious of these new models. If I was buying new, sure, of course I'd get the newest thing. If I needed it, sure, I'd get it. But the ones from, you know, a year and a half ago, or whenever these came out, are still amazing. And I'm not motivated to upgrade.
Yep. I still love my M1 MacBook Pro, which is what I'm using to talk to you fine folks right now. Frank Styler had a very interesting piece of feedback. Frank writes, as the topic of how do you back up your iCloud photos regularly comes up on your show, and I've recently started using iCloud more and more and did not like any of the available options, I decided to take things into my own hands. About 6 months ago, I started work on my open source project, iCloud Photo Sync, that allows you to pull your whole library into the native file system. There's even a Docker version, so Casey can run it on a Synology Pi, Mac Mini, etc. Once synced, you can use the backup service of your choice to persist everything securely, because this is a sync program, not a backup program. Please note, I'm doing this in my free time, and only thanks to the time during my Christmas break, I was finally able to reach version 0.1. I am very happy with the project. I feel the sync algorithm is stable. However, did not yet encounter a library the size of John's. In the future, I will be able to support shared photo libraries, but haven't gotten around to implementing it yet. So I have not tried this myself, but I went picking, looking around the GitHub repository. And it looks pretty slick just based on like the documentation stuff I looked at. It looks pretty, pretty slick. And this is something that I don't know if I necessarily have a need for this because of my absolutely bananas ingestion system that I've been using for years. But if I wasn't me and I was any normal human, I would definitely be taking a look at this.
Related to this, I didn't put it in here, but we have a bunch of Ask ATP questions that I didn't bother putting in because I felt like we'd answered this more recently. But people keep asking, I want to back up my iCloud photo library, but I don't either don't want to have or don't currently have a Mac where I can do the option in Apple's Photos app that says download originals just because they don't have the disk space. Like my library is too big. It can't fit on my Mac, but can I back it up? And the answer is no. Like you have to have the data to back it up. But with something like this, you know, the selection of Macs that you have in your house no longer need be the limiting factor. You could, if assuming this thing works, again, I didn't try it either, but assuming this thing works, open source project that runs in a Docker container, you could rent an instance from Linode for a couple bucks a month, run this little thing on it, pull everything down there. You know, like there are solutions that don't involve running a Mac all the time. People are also asking, do I have to leave my user logged into my account the whole time? Do I have to leave the Photos app open? The answer to those is no, you don't need to leave Photos open. I don't think you need to be logged in, but I haven't tested that. But either way, like messing with that and worrying that you're not like that you that it's not pulling everything down that you want to be pulled down, this takes the guesswork out of that. It's a, you know, it's a thing. You run it when you want to run it. It syncs the contents and then you point whatever backup system you have at that and then that backs it up. It's much more straightforward than trying to divine the behavior of Apple's completely faceless, completely uncontrollable sync services, which we all love to hate, because, you know, there's no way to tell it to stop, no way to tell it to start, no way to say do it now, no way to check whether it's done anything. And all these, even if we were to, like, you know, figure out experimentally, yes, it runs when you're not logged in, yes, you don't have to run photos, that can change in a point update, right? You can't rely on that. So for backups, it's much better to have something that you're relatively sure about. Like, for example, the feature in Apple Photos says download originals. That's straightforward. Maybe it doesn't work because of a bug, but its intention is clear. Right. And it will tell you if it runs out of disk space, like, I, you know, disk is full, couldn't download the stuff or whatever. And this command line thing, similarly, if it works, you know, you have total control over it. So that's what I would suggest, not trying to play guess whether, you know, it's downloading stuff when I'm not logged in or whatever.
All right. And then very briefly, a handful of listeners reached out with regard to apps for small kids. First of all, a few people said Khan Academy Kids, K-H-A-N, is kind of like ABC Mouse, but without the fees. I put that on our kiddo iPad, and Michaela's been playing with it a little bit, and she seems to really like it. Also, for iOS developers, Andy Matushak, I believe I pronounced that correctly, who is formerly kind of one of the big cheeses on UIKit and did a lot of really great WWDC sessions many years back. He was at Khan Academy in their R&D department for a few years. So he is an alumni. I'm pretty sure he's not there anymore. And then speaking of ABC Mouse, this is from Will. And Will writes, with regard to ABC Mouse, several public libraries in the U.S. offer free accounts if you have a library card. The Washington, D.C. library is one that comes to mind. Some of these libraries even offer library cards to non-residents for a fee, sometimes, or sometimes even for free, for much less than what ABC Mouse charges monthly. By using a library card, you also get access to all the library's other online resources as well. So you might want to check that out if this is of interest to you. So, gentlemen, apparently we're all going to be getting foldable iPads with carbon fiber kickstands next year, baby. Who's excited?
Because if there's one thing I wanted carbon fiber on, it's the kickstand to a tablet. Because you know what it's like when those kickstands are heavy.
Right, right.
this is a fun rumor along multiple axes. So we've talked about foldable devices many times. There are many foldable devices shipping. I think they're mostly phones, although I think there's like some tablet-sized ones. The magic of screen technology allows us to fold them in various ways. So this is a foldable rumor. It's a carbon fiber rumor. We always love them because we always want Apple to experiment with new materials because they've done aluminum glass for a long time. Aluminum glass are great, but maybe there could be something better, lighter, stronger, more durable, all those things. And then kickstand, let's throw that in too, because the iPad does not really have a kickstand in the Microsoft Surface sense, as in like a panel that folds out at various angles, right? You could say the little triangle origami thing that you make out of the Apple, whatever they're called, smart cover things, is kind of like a kickstand, but it's not really. A kickstand is more like a panel that hinges out from the back of the thing at various angles. And so then this rumor is that the kickstand would be made of carbon fiber. This rumor doesn't make a lot of sense to me on multiple axes, but the collection of rumors related to Apple and foldable stuff continue to dribble out over the years. So there's Apple is certainly thinking about that, experimenting with that. But I kind of run into the same question I always have about foldable things is what advantage do I as a customer get for having a foldable thing other than it being cool and sci-fi-ish? And it's really difficult for me to answer that question, especially with something like an iPad, because iPads are big. And if I could fold it to be half the size, now it's half the size, but still pretty big, you know, and in exchange, I got to deal with all of the things that come along with folding. You know, is it going to be creased in the middle? Is it going to be bulky? How sharp can that curve be? There's a bunch of rumors related to that in here as well about like who's going to be supplying LG or something was going to be supplying the ultra thin cover glass that could be used on the company's foldable products. That would be cool. Instead of having to be plastic, have a big glass, but that, you know, then what's the radius on that bend or whatever. There's a lot of information surrounding all of these things here. And I still can't make any sense out of it in terms of the kind of product that I would want to buy. The pitch now has not yet been made to me for why I would want an iPad that folds.
I mean, I think the pitch is obvious. It's that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have something that's you know, pocket as pocketable as an iPad mini. Well, not pocketable, but you know
what I'm saying. Like, it's not, because it's half the size, right? If it folds in one direction, it's half, right? It's twice as thick, but half the length and width, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think with an iPad size thing that buys me anything. You've gone from really big to still pretty big. You know, like, I mean,
maybe
it doesn't become
a
pocketable.
Jacket pocket, maybe a big jacket. I don't know. I have yet to see any foldable screen device that really nails, like, okay, that was worth it. Like that
the foldable phone that folds vertically. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of these. I know Quinn Nelson's got one of them. He likes over that. I can kind of see. Like, I feel like that does. What we're talking about is like a vertical phone that folds down, so it's more like a little square. I think that does make it more pocketable, especially with big phones, than when it's vertical. Because phones, you know, phones already fit in your pocket. And usually the limiting factor for pocketability is not the thickness. So trading, I want to be twice as thick, but then half the length and half the width, makes sense for a trade-off if pocketability is your limiting factor. But in exchange for that, with the phone thing, now you got to constantly be folding it and unfolding it. And unlike the flip phones, it's not as cool to do. You know, remember when we had flip phones, you could do the little flippy thing?
Yeah, let me just flip
it
on my iPad.
Snap it closed. Whack. And then you snap it closed and everything like that. It's not quite the same. Like, and we're like, if you don't think that's a big deal, like, we all just take our phones out and look at them and put them back in. There's no folding and unfolding process in there. Adding that step is a complication that you really like that trade-off. You really need to be like pocket limited. Maybe if you're, you know, a woman who's constantly stuck buying clothes that have no pockets on them, that is your limiting factor, in which case, you know, thumbs up. But remember, we're not talking about a phone here. We're talking about an iPad. iPad is never going to be pocketable, even if you're wearing overalls, especially in some of the rumors like 20-inch foldable iPad. That's still pretty big once you fold it. Like, no, so here's the other angle on this, and it kind of goes into the kickstand thing. What if it folds and the horizontal part could be a keyboard and then the vertical part is the screen? Sure, I guess. I don't know if people are jazzed to use an iPad with an on-screen keyboard in an L shape. It seems like people like using iPads with physical keyboards as like little mini floppy laptops, but on-screen you know what I'm saying? Like, make it like a laptop, but have, you know, one half of the screen be the keyboard part, and then it could change it to a tablet part and do, you know, I get how that could work. It doesn't appeal to me. It's not solving a problem I feel like I have with the iPad, and it is bringing a bunch of other weird stuff with it.
That's kind of the problem with all foldable stuff we've seen so far, is that it doesn't really seem to solve problems that we have, and it might be a fun novelty here and there, especially maybe on phones, but I don't see it happening. Like, suppose we succeed in creating a foldable tablet or laptop-sized device. What have we made? We've made a worse laptop. Like, in every way, it's worse. It's more fragile. It's more expensive. The keyboard sucks. Like, I don't... And then what have we gained by that? Well, you could, I guess, unfold into a flat screen and have a big screen with no keyboard. I don't know. I don't know why this is something that we are focused on so much in the tech world as being like some cool new thing on the horizon. Because whatever,
I mean, it is cool. That's why you see stories about it.
It's one of those, like, it's cool in the CES sense. Where it's like, it's cool in the sense that, wow, that's a fun demo to see at a trade show. But it's not a product you'd actually want to live with for the most part for most people.
I mean, some people do like it with phones. So let me just show you some of the highlights of how all over the place these rumors are, right? So this is Ming-Chi Kuo saying that he was, quote, positive that the foldable device will arrive in 2024, but did not provide a more specific time frame. Then another bit of rumor here from CCS Insight says that Apple plans to use a foldable iPad in 2024 as a practice run for foldable technology before adopting it on the iPhone. Again, I think a foldable iPhone makes way more sense than a foldable iPad. Doing a weird product as a practice run doesn't seem like, you know, a thing, but whatever. And this is Ross Young talking about the 20-inch size. Young expects the device to hit the market a lot later, in 2026 or 2027. Well, that's a daring rumor because it's way out in the future. Then LG with the ultra-thin cover glass. Ross Young said he is expecting multiple OLED iPads in 2024. Now we're talking. I've wanted an OLED on the iPad for a long time. That has nothing to do with foldable. This just has to do with a higher quality screen with really good blacks. But Ross Young said he's heard nothing about a foldable iPad in the same year. And here's another update from Mark Gurman. He says that he has not heard anything about a foldable iPad in 2024, which he expects to be the year of the OLED iPad Pro models and spec bumps for the entry-level iPad and iPad Mini. So I want to believe the more conservative rumors that just say OLED iPads are coming, because that is a straightforward upgrade to iPads with a better screen, something that I've really wanted because I watch tons of TV on my iPad, and an OLED screen will be better. I also kind of believe that Apple has been working on foldable iPhones for a long time. It would be irresponsible for them not to be looking into that. There are foldable phones on the market, and there have been for a long time, and some people like them for the reasons I described before. You got to at least look into it on the iPhone. You know, maybe it'll just be one model that's foldable. Maybe it'll be like the return of the mini is like a thing that folds up or whatever. Sure, thumbs up. Foldable iPad rumors, and especially the carbon fiber kickstand, I honestly have no idea where that's coming from, but I suppose stranger things have happened.
Yeah, I think it was on Upgrade that Jason and Mike had said a couple of interesting things. First of all, you know, where is the fold? And I forget the terminology for this, but I think they described it as innie or outie. So if the thing folds like a book, right, and the display is on the inside, then what do you do when it's folded up, right? And this is what you were talking about with the phone as well. Like, you have to unfold it to use it. That doesn't seem terribly useful. But then if it's the other direction where the display...
If it's in the any one, though, that's the way where you could use it as a laptop with a screen keyboard.
That's true.
Like, you would keep it open in an L shape, and you would have it in front of you, and now the fold is letting you use it as a mini laptop kind of type deal with a kickstand behind it.
Right. Whereas if you go outie, then that potentially means that you can use it folded, but that's still, it's basically you have two modes completely. Oh, well,
yeah,
completely
and one screen is like, presumably you're touching it with your hand, so it would have to be like palm rejection on the side right. That's not facing
mm-hmm,
you.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And the other thing they said, maybe it was Jason, but I don't remember for sure, that I thought was really astute is this feels like one of those things, if it's true, this feels like one of those things, and actually this is also true of the headset, which we'll probably be getting to in just a moment. It feels like one of those things that we're just not seeing it, and Apple will, you know, slap something on the table and say, oh, this is it. This is why you want this. And all of us will be, oh, yes, I do want that. Yes, please. I'll take three. You know,
or just as likely, Apple will never release this product because they will look at it and say there is no reason for you to want this product. So never mind. But eventually we'll get a foldable phone.
Yep. No, I agree with that. So I agree with what you're saying, John, especially that, you know, I don't get what the draw is. I don't understand why I want this in my life. But, you know, Apple's got to throw stuff against the wall, see what sticks. And if this is something they're throwing against the wall, then power to them.
I think they should throw it against the wall in Apple Park and only show it to us if it sticks.
Fair enough. All right. Hi, Future Marco. This is only an hour in, but I don't know. Do we want to conquer the headset thing? Do we think this is going to last a while?
Or a shorter thing? I think we're just going to do the first part of the headset thing. We don't have time to enumerate all the rumors, but we'll see.
All right. Here we go. All right. So let's talk headset. Apple's Reality Pro AR/VR goggles. And as John put in the show notes, I think, what is it good for? And we don't know. We really don't know. But the information has information. They're saying in short that, hey, you're going to be able to like write apps and stuff without even writing code. It's going to be amazing. What?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think this is a quote. I think you should read this quote because this is directly from the information, which broke this story. And it's the type of 9to5 Mac summarized it. But I always like to try to go back to the source to see like, what did they actually say? Because the 9to5 Mac story reads nonsensically. Non-coders will be able to write VR apps using Siri. Like, what? But yeah, the actual quote
doesn't help. I can't play music using Siri reliably. Like, how's that going to work?
I literally, yesterday
morning, going downstairs after breakfast. Hey, Siri, stop. It's playing music. Wait. Delay. One sec. Wait. The music's still playing this whole time. Wait. Oh, something went wrong. Blasting music again. Like, it's just, it can't even stop reliably. Like, for God's sake, how are we going to write apps using Siri when Siri still, like, what is it, 12 years after it was unveiled, still can't do the basics reliably?
Just before I came to record, we were in the living room, the other room where all my various devices listen to me is, and we were We wanted to know what year the original Superman movie was released, and I made my guess, which turned out to be right. Thank you very much. But then, of course, we did the thing. You know, no one believes me. They need to double check with the internet, right? So I did my normal Bake Off. So and I don't like. I'm not good at speaking to devices. I gave it a kind of a weird, kind of strangely structured sentence. I think I said something. And I always try Google first because it's going to be the good one. And I said, you know, I said to the Google thing, what year was the original Superman movie starring Christopher Reeve released in? And that is a weirdly structured sentence because I don't get to the released in part till the end. And I say like original movie and like I don't just say like what was the year of release of or when was, you know, like his release is at the end and you got to connect all this stuff. It nailed it. It gave me the answer. It's in 1978. That's what Google said. Right. And I, you know, later on I did a second question, which is, how old is Chris Novoselic? Do you know what the Google device said to me? 57. It just said 57. It didn't say, according to the page of Wikipedia, blah, blah, blah. It just told me the answer like a human would. Right?
Imagine
anyway,
that.
I also asked both of these questions in pretty much the same way to my original HomePod.
Oh, no.
Fell on its face. The first one, it's like, the webpage, blah, 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 says, and it started reading a bunch of crap about Superman. Didn't get the date, and I was like, all right. Stop, right? You know, and it did, to its credit, it did stop. And then I asked about Chris Novoselic, and it started reading, it started reading some other web page that was not relevant. It was just like, 0-2 as usual. Google's voice assistant still champion. I was particularly impressed about how it just said 57. Like, yes, I don't need a preamble. I don't need a postamble. I don't need to be addressed. I just want the answer. Oh, and by the way, the answer was real, real fast. Apple, yeah. What are you doing?
That's
anyway, let's write some VR apps.
Whoever at Apple is in charge of Siri this year, because it seems to be a bit of a revolving door there, I would love for them to just spend one day in my house using my HomePods. Just please. However you think Siri's working out there in California on whatever hardware you're using, I urge you, come here to New York and use it on my HomePods and tell me everything's all right. Like, try doing anything on my HomePods for one day.
By the way, that's another, like, I watched a bunch of the new HomePod reviews and everything. I mean, obviously we're weird and niche here or whatever, but I was amazed at how few of them, pretty much none of them, made any mention. I mean, maybe they mentioned in the specs, like, oh, this has X processor and the old one had Y processor, but none of them talked about, why do I care about that? Why do I care that the new HomePod has a different processor? Like, was there a weakness of the old pod related to the processor that might, you know, like, they didn't test response time. They didn't say it's great that it's faster. They didn't check whether it responds fast. They didn't do any of that. It's like, I know Apple doesn't talk about its specs or whatever, but I feel like one of the things we hope, and Marco will tell us, is an improvement in the new thing is it has a new processor and it will be faster. And the comparison point, like Marco said on the last show, is the Mini, which has the same processor that seems to be, you know, none of the reviews did any of that. It's like it didn't even exist to them. It was very disappointing.
Well, I feel like you know, the HomePod is a product. I mean, going back to this for a minute, the HomePod is a product. It's something that, again, like, these are tech reviewers. They could not care less about the new HomePod on average. Like, some of them maybe are better than others, but, like, the people who get Apple review units, and, like, you know, all, like, the YouTubers and the big publications and everything, this is not an area of their incredible specialty or care. Like, this is an accessory product. They review the HomePod the same way they would review, like, you know, an iPad smart cover. Like, okay, I'm going to try this. It'll be cool. But how comprehensively,
I mean,
are you going
to
look
at it? A lot of the,
you
channels know, did compare it to the competitors. Here's how it compares to the Amazon things. Here's how it compares to the Google things. And I think if you're making that comparison, one of the things you test is, hey, when I ask it a question, how long does it take to give me an answer? And how well does it answer those questions?
Oh, well,
I've seen a lot of reviews.
I mean, now you're talking.
I've seen
about
a lot of reviews of, like bake-offs, like I do in my house all the time, of, like, ask device A, ask device B, say how they weld. But response time, maybe it's just a sore point for us because we're impatient. But I feel like that is one of, like, a new HomePod arrives, and that's one of the things I care about, because all the past HomePods haven't been real snappy with the answers. And so if a new HomePod arrives and it has a new SoC that is, this, you know, more updated and hopefully that, you know, as fast as it was in the Mini, that's a thing I would test and mention in my review. But these guys just, anyway, whatever. I don't want to bag on YouTube reviewers. It's great that they got review units.
Yeah, no, but it really, like, I think also a big part of this is that Siri has been so bad and slow and unreliable for so long that it's kind of given now. Like, no one
even just given up on it.
Yeah, and like nobody, when you're reviewing a product that relies so heavily on Siri as the HomePods do, you don't even spend much time talking about how crappy and slow and mediocre Siri is, because everyone just knows that. And we've just given up expecting anything more. Like, that's again, like, I really hope that whoever the current leader of Siri is this week actually thinks it's as bad as it is, because that, like, it's, if they know it's bad, then that gives us hope that, okay, maybe they're really going to rethink this. Maybe they're going to really put a lot behind this. Cause like, obviously, like, Google and even Amazon are way better at it in so many ways. So it's like, obviously, like, it's possible to do well. It's been possible to do well for quite some time now. But if Apple knows it sucks, then great. Then that's step one, is learning you have a problem and admitting, hey, we can do better. But I honestly wonder, like, does Apple think this is good? Because obviously all their PR always says how good it is, and they have to, of course. But, like, internally, behind closed doors, do they know how crappy Siri is? Do they know that it can be better? Like, I'm not sure they do. I don't know if we've seen enough evidence that they actually believe that or have any idea how to make it better.
Well, so
you
just
send them some of my free Google Home Minis. Do they just have them sitting next to their HomePods? And the next time you want to know when a movie recently released or how old a celebrity is, ask both. See how it goes for you.
Yeah, well, I think, Marco, you said three different things. You know, does Apple know that Siri is trash? I think they do. It wouldn't entirely surprise me if they don't, but I think they do. What were the other two? Can they fix it? That I'm less convinced about, because they've had a long time to fix it, and I don't know if they're capable of it. Shoot, I forgot what the third thing was. That's all right. But whenever I've talked to engineers at Apple, now granted, I've not talked to any Siri engineers, possibly because they don't exist. I don't know. But one way or the other, I've never talked to Siri engineers, but, you know, general rank and file Apple, you know, software engineers, they claim, and I believe them, that they are their own biggest critics, that they make John look like a pushover, you know, in that they know in and out how garbage so much of their stuff is. Now, they also make excuses for it, much like they make excuses for Radar and Feedback Assistant, because they know how the sausage is made. They know why, you know, a stage manager sucks. And they might even know why Siri sucks. Because, oh, well, we don't have the this, that, and the other thing, or, oh, you know, corporate politics, or, oh, this or that. But they know that it sucks. Like, that's not up for grabs. They know. But again, the question is, can they do anything about it, and or do they care enough to do anything about it? And I don't know the answer to those questions.
You're saying that rank and file employees know, but as you go up the org chart, it becomes and more important for you not to know that. Because right. When you have to say, I'm in charge of Siri, it's time for my annual review. How'd you do? Week two, great. We made huge improvements to Siri, and Siri's doing great. It is good for your career to actually believe fair. That Siri is doing great, because then you can convincingly say that Siri is doing great, so you can get your raise and your new stock options. Whereas at the rank and file, when you're just down there, you can have a more clear-eyed view of, you know, Siri's bad because it doesn't have the resources, or was moved from X department to Y, or everybody quit, or whatever.
Yep, that's completely fair.
Anyway, VR headset. Should we read this passage from the information about making apps with it? So here's what they say. With the software tools, Apple hopes that even people who don't know computer code could tell the headset via the Siri voice assistant to build an AR app that could be then be made available via Apple's App Store for others to download. So that is quite a claim. It's saying not only will you be able to do something with Siri that makes something that could be considered an app, but that you could then put them on the App Store as well. The tool, for example, could allow users to build up an app with virtual animals moving around a room and over or around real-life objects without the need to design the animal from scratch, program its animations, and calculate its movements in 3D space, and so on and so forth. And 9to5Mac notes, this is similar to features already offered by headsets from Meta. The Quest headsets, for example, have an app called Horizon Worlds that allows users to build 3D environments without coding. Additionally, features similar to this have already appeared on the iPhone as part of Apple's other augmented reality and virtual reality work, right? This is much less interesting than the story makes it seem. It's like, okay, you can make a thing in AR VR out of a bunch of pieces that are pre-made and you assemble them. And that could, in theory, be packaged up in a few standardized ways into an app that you could then put in an app store. Kind of reminds me of the ebook plague of the early days of the app store, where it's really easy to package up an ebook in an iOS app and put it on the App Store and make some quick money before Apple realizes this is a terrible idea and bans the practice. Only now it's Apple doing it by saying, hey, make a thing with a bunch of animals that walk around your living room and upload it to the App Store. All right, sure, whatever. And this is leading us to the title of this section that Casey tried to sing and I think may not have pulled it off to the point where people understood what he was saying. Marco can put in the clip here if people don't know what he was referencing. What is this ARVR headset good for? Again, we're not talking about a pair of glasses that you wear that can project things into them, because there's a million awesome uses for that. We're talking about a headset, a thing that is pretty big, pretty bulky, has a lot of computing power, has peripherals, has like a battery, which may or may not be clipped to your belt, which was the style at the time. It's like, why would I want to buy it? It may be expensive. Why would I want to buy this? What is it good for? Here's from Bloomberg. People familiar with Apple's content strategy for the headset say Apple executives are emphasizing health and wellness, including proposals for AR apps that assist with meditation and exercise. One early AR demo allowed users to sit inside a Zen garden. All right, sure. Another Apple demo for executives allow users to walk through the Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, by blending its fantastical environment with the real world. All right.
Oh, my word.
These all sound like cool tech demos. Still waiting to figure out what's going to make me want to buy, you know, this big headset, and what's going to make me want to strap it to my head to pick up potentially the two things that I might have to hold in my hand to make it work. Gruber took a shot at it and went through, because he's had the same question for a long time, and he wrote a big article about it called The Billions Dollar Question. What is it good for? He came up, you know, so here's his summary. What are the intended use cases for Apple's headset? After you buy it, unbox it, and power it on, what are you supposed to do with it? What features and experiences will seem worth spending $1,000 or even thousands of dollars? I ponder this every day, and I come up short. And so in his article, he lists everything he could think of, and I'm just going to give the bullet points here, and you can read his article to see what he has to say about them. The things he came up with is what you might use it for is games, movies and TV, virtual meetings with FaceTime-like calls, personal computing via projected displays. And then he says, I can't think of any other use cases for a VR, XR headset. I cannot believe that such a headset would be intended for wearing around as you go about daily life, augmenting the real world with virtual displays and ambient contextual information. That's what we need AR glasses for, not AR goggles. And you can read his summaries of descriptions of why he thinks games, movies, TV, virtual meetings, and personal computing with projected displays probably aren't going to make him want to use this thing. But and there's probably more items that you can hit, and I can look at each one of those items and say, well, if Apple did a good job of games, that would be a reason. If Apple did a really good job of virtual meetings, that might be a reason. But again, read the Gruber article to see all the countervailing forces. I don't think I have to describe the countervailing forces when it comes to Apple and games. We know about those. Virtual meetings, the countervailing forces are like Microsoft and Google, also pretty big forces. You know, just anyway, I thought it was a good article, and I thought it was a good time to revisit the idea of like, what are we supposed to use this thing for? And finally, the reason we're talking about this now for the umpteenth time is that the rumors are heating up about Apple's AR VR goggle thing. Gurman's latest thing, he said that is reportedly set to be announced sometime this spring, with launch to consumers happening later this fall. So around WWDC-ish time, rumors say Apple may actually be ready to release this thing. This thing that the earlier rumor was that it might actually be released before the end of last year. Obviously, that didn't happen. But if they're ready to release something, the mystery of, as Gruber says, when I take it out of the box, what am I supposed to use it for? That mystery kind of remains.
Yeah, I keep thinking back to previous Apple new platform launch, you know, warm-ups. Like when we were about to get the iPad or the Apple Watch, you know, we kind of knew ahead of time, like, oh, hey, they're working on something. Even the phone, like, we kind of knew they were working on a phone. That was the thing, a special case, because that really blew us away.
The Apple TV. People don't remember that was going to launch as iTV. People think, oh, there was never any question about what you can use the Apple TV for. If you remember what the original iTV thing was intended to do versus what the little puck does, it's similar, but kind of like all the other products you've named, the what you're supposed to use this product for actually has evolved over time as the market has decided, no, this is what we want to do with it. So, for example, DVRing things from broadcast television is not a feature that Apple went with for their TV connected boxes, but it could have been because the technical capabilities were there. It just turned out that's not what the market wanted.
Yeah. And like, you know, when you look at these previous product launches, you know, like look at the iPad, for instance. You know, when Apple was rumored to, you know, the iPhone was already going for a couple of years by that point, and they were rumored to be doing a tablet. And the rumors ended up being, you know, not too far off. Everyone kind of knew, like, okay, it's going to be like a big iPhone. That, you know, they got the price wrong, with it famously. But for the most part, like, you know, we were wondering, and at the time, you know, there were other tablets that predated it, and they weren't very compelling. They had a market. You know, there were a couple different types of tablets. There were like the PC world's kind of tablets, which were actually like usually convertible laptops where you like flip the screen around, and those did okay, like in certain industries. And then they had, like, remember right before the iPad, they had, like, the Crunch Pad, and there was some other, like, little startup.
Crunch Pad.
There was some other, like,
remember the Crunch
dumb
Pad,
startup
please.
That was, like, $1,000 for their tablet, too. And it was
One of the things about the iPad launch that's interesting to remember is kind of like the headset launch. Before Apple has launched a product entry into a space is the time of, kind of like Gruber was covering it, the time of infinite possibilities, right? There are lots of things this could be, and people's minds go wild. Well, this could be X, this could be Y, but there's no actual product yet. We haven't seen what Apple has released, so we don't know what they're going to do, but we have all these ideas that could be possible. One of the most fantastical ones around the iPad was, if you remember this one, the iPad's going to save newspapers. Do you remember that one?
Oh,
right,
word.
It's going to save magazines and newspapers because there's a business that existed for lots of the lives of people who were writing articles at the time. You know, old people remember magazines and newspapers, and they're dying. And Apple's going to come out with a tablet. So one thing this tablet could do is it could save magazines and newspapers by making a modern digital equivalent, and all those newspaper reporters and magazine writers will keep their jobs and their pensions and still continue to be paid $20 a word and whatever the hell, you know, like that didn't happen really in the way that people expected. But before there is a product, there's lots of fantastical ideas about what it could be. And then the other analogy, which I'm sure you're going to get to eventually, Marco, is the Apple Watch, where Apple itself had lots of very fantastical ideas of what the product could be, even when it was launching it. But we eventually narrowed it down.
Yeah. But going back to the iPad for a second. So in the lead up to the iPad launch, we were able to look at other tablets on the market that were in kind of, you know, moderate success maybe in certain areas, but hadn't really taken over, you know, the world by storm or anything like that. But we were able to look at other tablets in the market and see, well, tablets have the following shortcomings. You know, they're a little bit, you know, a little bit unwieldy to like have in a pocket or, you know, even most bags or anything, but you know, they're still useful. They're hard to have like text input on. We haven't really solved the tablet text input problem. And for all these problems that we would think of, we would say, well, I bet Apple has a plan, because Apple has such a good track record now at this point. Like I bet they have a plan to solve things like, you know, text input. And then the iPad came out, and it all those things that we thought Apple surely has a plan, we can't think of it. Well, it turns out they didn't have a plan for any of those things. They just tried to do a really good job with whatever they could do within those constraints. And what the iPad was a really good tablet that was the same type of thing that we'd already been imagining, just a good implementation of it. And so the Apple Watch comes along. Again, the rumors are that Apple's about to make some kind of smartwatch. Great. And by this point, we kind of knew their MO. We kind of like, okay, it's probably going to be like a tiny iPhone on your wrist. And yeah, it pretty much was that. Like that we pretty much nailed that. But everyone's like, oh, the smartwatch is going to replace your phone. You in a few years, you won't even be buying an iPhone anymore. And here we are many years later, and we're all still buying iPhones. And the Apple Watch, while it has good attributes and good uses, and it's a good product in itself, it really hasn't overcome the fundamental limitations of smartwatches. You still only have to use it one-handed because naturally it's strapped to your other hand and your hand doesn't bend that way. It still has a very small display, very limited battery power compared to a phone, and very limited, you know, computing resources as a result of its small size and limited power budget and everything else. There are certain things that the smartwatch just can't really do because of its physical realities. And so again, there were other smartwatches that came before the Apple Watch, and Apple came out and did something within the realm of what we already knew to be plausible. Just a good job of it eventually. They found their way through a little bit of stumbling at the beginning there, but they found their way. It's now a good product. By the way, I hate to, I admitted last week that Gruber was right about his stupid gloves, his stupid thin North Face gloves. I now have to admit he's right about one more thing. This is almost as bad as when John's right about something. When the Apple Watch first came out, there were two leather bands for the large. There were three leather bands. There was the modern buckle, which was only available for the small size, still around today. A very nice buckle, but it's usually only available for the small watches. Then there was the classic leather strap, which they don't make anymore. That was just basically a regular like black leather strap, like any other watch with a buckle and everything like that. They stopped making that a few years in. And then they had this thing called the leather loop. And the leather loop was kind of like the Milanese loop, where you have like it, where like the strap is like one long piece kind of goes through the buckle on one side, and then like the excess then folds back over and magnets to itself. And I had such high hopes for that leather loop, and I tried it on in a store, and I was so disappointed by how just rock hard it was. It felt like a plastic loop. Because, you know, in each one of the segments was a magnet, and the leather was kind of sandwiching around it, and it just felt so rock hard, and it just...
Is this story leading to you touching a used, warm John Gruber watch strap?
No. So he told me, oh, you got to check out the new ones. They have since, I don't know when, I think a few years ago, they have since replaced the old leather loop with a new one called the leather link, which is now a two-piece, you know, a two-end strap, and one of them just magnets over the other one, so there's no more like loop and bend back. And however they've made this one differently materials-wise, it is so much nicer than the old leather loop. Like, it is by far the nicest looking strap for the Apple Watch if you're trying to dress it up that also feels really comfortable. Like, it is a really nice, soft, pliable, practical band. I ended up trying one in a store. I bought it. It is super nice. So anyway, if you're trying to, like, you know, like it's because it's leather, you know, obviously you have some, you know, animal concerns there, but also it doesn't deal well with things like moisture. And you know, I wouldn't work out in this band if I could help it. But if I was, say, like going on a trip somewhere and I wanted to just bring the Apple Watch and have it be like a little bit dressed up so I could, you know, kind of look a little bit nice on my trip, no question I'd use this band, the new leather link. It's so much nicer than you think it is. And it's much softer than you think it would be based on the old leather loop thing. And I think it looks pretty good and it's nicely adjustable and everything. So anyway, big thumbs up for that. Anyway, going back to where we were. Thanks a lot, John Gruber. So going back, you know, as we look at the AR headset now, we're in that kind of lead up period where there are other, or not AR, sorry, the mixed reality headset, because obviously it seems like we're not near AR yet. So there are other products in this realm that we can look at, most notably the Quest line. You know, we can see that, and we can see they are a successful product line. People do buy them. People do watch video in them. They do play games in them. I don't think a lot of people use them as second screen to their computers because I think they're just too low resolution. And you know, obviously the Apple product is rumored to be pretty high spec in that realm, so maybe it can be better. And Meta does have their like whatever the is it Horizon Workrooms? Whatever the thing is that Ben Thompson always talks about as being like
virtual meetings. Let's sit around a virtual table and stare at our virtual faces and talk with each other.
Yeah, which almost everyone who's tried it basically says, yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't want to do it, but it's pretty cool. And everyone says, yeah, like if everyone bought one of these and we could do this all day and it was comfortable, then yes, our meetings would be better.
Yeah, well, I mean, that last part, that's a lot of ifs. The key part there. Yeah, well, everyone buying them is like, okay, well, then what if your work buys them? That's fine. But being comfortable, that's where you start getting into technical limitations of these things are not small. There is a... not a social cost, but there is a weirdness of strapping them on. There is the practicality of strapping them on and strapping them off. And then it's just like, what advantage do you get? I mean, you know, the thing I think about is, especially during all the COVID times when we're all like working remotely and everything, the social and cultural developments surrounding whether or not you have your camera turned on. I don't know if you two probably didn't do lots of virtual meetings, but I was at my jobby job for most of the first few years of COVID and everything. And that was a thing. Do you even turn your camera on? Should you ask people to turn their camera on? Should students in classes have to turn their camera on or not? Should you force people to turn their camera on? Is it polite to even ask them to if they have it off? How does that change in school versus work? That was just simply basically toggling a switch in software. Now imagine what it will be like in terms of we're going to all have a meeting, take this multi-hundred or thousand-dollar device that work bought for you and strap it on your head. Oh, you don't want to strap it on your head? Why don't I see you at the virtual table? I can hear your voice, and maybe I can even see you on the camera, but why don't you put the headset on, Jill? I don't want to put the headset on.
Why can't I see your face at all times?
It's going to mess up my hair. It's uncomfortable. I have a headache from being inside it. It makes me motion sick. Do I have to do this as part of my job? If only some people are on their headset and other people aren't on headsets in the meeting, does that make it a haves and have not thing? Kind of like people who are meeting in person versus the people who are meeting remote. So much complexity around this that it is not, even if you're setting aside that this is never going to happen because Microsoft owns that market and Apple's never going to be able to sell to the enterprise because they suck at that and blah, 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 and all that other, stuff in there. Just the idea that like the killer app is going to be virtual meetings with a headset like this, I have such a hard time believing it, no matter how good it is, simply because of what I just said. Like that we have experience with things that are much less invasive and much simpler, and that we all really do have, laptops with cameras and everything on them like that. We've crossed all the hurdles, and yet we still have the difficulty of should I be on camera or not? I haven't combed my hair. I'm still in my pajamas. Is it important to be on camera? And all we're asking you to do is click a button, not strap a, a couple pounds of plastic and batteries and technology to your face.
Yeah, like there's so many issues if we actually get to this world of everyone has VR headsets so we can do meetings in them. Like, and we aren't even there yet. I mean, we're still, again, like we're still talking about, like, is this product even going to be, compelling to people? And that's the thing, like when you look at these products today, you can see the use cases. You can see, Gruber's article citing these things. Like, this is what people do with the ones that are out there now, but it seems like it's more of a novelty or a specialty product, and it does not seem like anything the mass market really wants yet.
Well,
now,
I mean, it's novelty and specialty in mass market. Like, the place where that doesn't apply is games. Games are mass market. Games are not a novelty. Games are bigger than movies, television, everything combined. Games are huge. Games are the main application for VR headsets and has driven most of the development for VR headsets. The technology we have is from Oculus and from Valve doing their, like, that's why these things exist, because people play games for entertainment in shortish spurts. Huge advantages to VR in games. Like, games make sense for VR. But the reason we all give a funny face about this, like, oh, you can't think of anything you'd want to use a cool VR headset for? Well, what about games? Like, because we know Apple sucks at games for the million reasons that we've talked about it. Like, that's what it, and it's not like there are no entrants in this space. Valve has a headset that's really good and expensive and works with a bunch of really good games. And even there, in the giant, vast market of games, so far, based on current levels of technology, most people are playing games on their television or on their phone or on their iPad or on their whatever, on their console or on their PC rather than a headset. They'll buy a $2,000 gaming PC so they can play their favorite game at super high resolution, higher frame rates, and they will choose to do that instead of buying a VR headset because there aren't enough good games, because people get motion sick, because the VR games are not compelling enough to make people buy an additional $1,000 thing to connect to their $2,000 PC. There's all sorts of reasons why we haven't quite gotten there, but games are potentially a huge market. And even there, with existing entrants, with really good technology, that if Apple is simply incrementally better than them, given Apple's inability to really grok and succeed in the gaming market outside of mobile games, because obviously they're very successful in mobile games, and I don't think mobile games lend themselves too well to VR, that's what makes it a puzzle. And movies and TV are also mass market, but I feel like that is another place where people have mostly chosen to buy a large television and sit on their couch rather than to strap something on their head. Because again, if the family's going to sit down and watch a show, now everyone needs to have a headset, or if one person has the headset and everyone else is watching the screen, it's weird, right? Those are the mass market things: meetings, movies, TV, games, just going from Gruber's list, right? Personal computing via projected displays, you know, like I think there are mass market uses for projecting computer images in front of your eyeballs, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about projecting computer images in front of your eyeballs with a thing that looks more or less like existing headsets, that weighs the same, looks the same, has the same limitations. It's not the same as putting on a pair of your Clark Kent glasses and being able to see people's names hovering above their head, which, as we know, is the killer app for augmented reality.
Yeah, and even I mean, and that has its own set of like weird, creepy issues. But you know, just again, like just going back to the to what we know now is like, you know, the most likely like, you know, mixed reality headset kind of thing. I don't see this being a big deal. And look, maybe again, if we say this every time, maybe they're going to blow us away with something that we are not thinking of. But it, again, if you look back at their previous new product launches in young hardware categories, they usually have not come up with things we hadn't thought of. They just do a good job of what we already knew to exist.
And slow down. What about digital touch, baby?
The most personal device you'll ever own. So here's the reason we think about this is because there is the phenomenon where a technology has existed for a long time and Apple does a better one. We see that all the time, right? But there is a phenomenon where Apple does a better one and the increment they are better crosses some divide that we didn't previously know existed. And the obvious example of that is the iPhone. Tons of touchscreen iPhones. Touchscreens had existed. Smartphones had existed. Touchscreen smartphones had existed. All those things exist before the iPhone. iPhone is better than them. Sure, Apple makes it comes out with a phone. It is a touchscreen phone. It is better than previous ones. But it was better by enough to cross over this chasm. And the chasm was going from a weird product that nerds are into to a thing that literally every person on Earth can use really, really easily and get used to it. With the responsiveness, the scrolling, the intuitive, you know, like Apple did that. The iPhone was only, you know, let's say 50% better than the phones that came before it, but that 50% jumped over a gap. We didn't know that like touchscreens are like suck, you know, responsiveness, whatever, however you want to measure it. There's this much lag, this much, you cross this threshold of responsiveness and ease of use. And it's a discontinuity. You go from not viable or nerd niche product like the Trio or whatever those Sony touchscreen phones were to this other thing that sweeps across the whole world. That's why we're interested in stuff like this. Okay, so they come out with an incrementally better headset. Does their increment of betterness cross a similar divide that suddenly brings it from the realm of weird, stupid crap that no one cares about to mass market, or does it not? And it's so hard to tell with that. The other things you listed didn't do that. The watch was better than other smartwatches by a huge margin, I think. A huge increment. Think of the best smartwatch that existed before the Apple Watch and the Apple Watch. I think it made a huge leap, but it didn't cross any sort of divide. You know what I mean? It didn't go from here's a thing that nobody wants to a thing that everybody wants. It just was a better smartwatch. It was better by, I think, a lot, but no, it didn't, you know, jump any kind of gap. And I think that's true of the iPad. It's the best tablet it had ever come out with, but it was similar to the iPhone in that we had already jumped the responsive touchscreen divide. So it was, we were on the other side of that. And this was just like, you know, like I said, a bigger iPhone, which is great and a useful thing, but, you know, didn't necessarily break any new ground. And the headset, you know, the reason people are interested in technology is we see a divide. If you can get out of thing that I strap onto my head that's bulky and big or whatever and get into a pair of glasses like that I'm wearing right now, but that I can see, you know, 8K displays in each of my eyeballs with, that is clearly over a divide. And suddenly that is a product that everyone on the planet is going to be like, yes, please give me that, right? But we don't have the technology yet. And Apple doesn't either. Like, they're not coming out with a pair of glasses. They're coming out with a headset. And people have already done that. So that is the question for this thing. Is it better? First of all, is it better? I think we all probably assume it's going to be better because it'll be the newest one. The newest one will have the best technology and the specs on it seem like they're pretty good or whatever, right? So it'll be good. Maybe it won't be as good as the highest of high-end gaming things. I think, you know, Meta, Facebook has scaled back on that and they're less interested in making the best of best for gaming with, like, you know, a multi-$1,000 device with the highest resolution and lowest response time. Feels like Valve is more, and what is that? Valve Index is what theirs is called. They're more aiming for that market, whereas Meta is trying to go mass market, which, whatever, I'm not sure that's a great decision, but either way, that's where they're going. So I think the Apple One will be like the best headset you can get in terms of the raw specs, and maybe it'll do some novel things, but it's going to be far, far away from a pair of glasses. And I don't think it's going to cross any sort of divide. where the audience for this product suddenly explodes, just like the audience for a touchscreen phone exploded after the iPhone.
I mean, frankly, I think if you look at where technology seems to be now, I think we're so far from that, from the idea of just like the glasses that are just like glasses and somehow project AR stuff and are powerful and powered and things like, you know, like we're so far from that, I think, that if we're looking at this as a product that's going to actually be like, you know, real and shipping soon, I think we have to think of it more like a VR headset than an AR product, just because it is so... It seems like we're so far from the AR dream here. And
I don't think we're as far as you think related to that, though, related to the last time about the touchscreen stuff or whatever, because I'm always keep, you know, reading these articles about screen technology, mostly in relation to television stuff. The latest set of screen tech that allows you to lay down very low power, very high fidelity, very high resolution, very thin screen material on transparent surfaces, is within the realm of our lifetime spec-wise in terms of just having a screen. Like, if you could put them in a pair of glasses, if these experimental stuff that they can make some tiny little postage stamp size of thing actually existed and were economical today, you could put them on glasses and then you could power them. What you're doing is powering them from your phone. So 2040, the idea of a pair of glasses with a high-res, high-fidelity color display that is wirelessly seeing what is projected from your smartphone, which will then be insanely powerful. It already is insanely powerful. Is plausible. So when you say we're so far away, it's not like the type of thing where we're like, we'll all be dead. I think it is plausible that the people on this podcast will be alive when something like that exists. And it's mostly has to do with screen technology, right? Because the screen, the technology to have a low power, lightweight screen that has the specs that we need is the limiting factor. Powering it, you know, all you need there is enough, you know, because you could just power it from your phone, right? Like, phones are incredibly powerful. In 20 years, they'll be even more powerful, hopefully. And then you can just project it, and the thing that's on your face is just a screen, right? That's not what this device is, even though it seems like it's tied to your iPhone. It's going to have its own SoCs in it, according to the rumors and all that other stuff, which is fine. And like I'm not... That's why I don't dismiss this entire market, because I think when they do cross that threshold, it will be really big, and I think we are in a generational shooting distance of getting there.
I think it's possible, but I do think like the products that people think of when they think of AR, you know, when I say we're not close, I'm thinking we, you know, we're like 10 years or more away. Not to say that it's our lifetime away. You know, hopefully we live longer than that. But you know, I'm thinking it's, you know, at least 10 years away probably from that kind of product. But you know, that brings the question up though of, okay, well, what do they do in the meantime? And in the meantime, you know, if they're going to have this product out there, that's more of like a VR or, you know, I mean, we'll see what, quote, mixed reality ends up being like. That's a huge question mark. Maybe they've done such a great job with mixed reality that maybe a lot of these questions become moot. And we don't know. Well, you know, we'll see when the product comes out, if the product comes out. You know, we'll see that. And, you know, because right now...
When you say mixed reality, what are you referring to? You're referring, like... Give me a use case. You're saying just projecting 3D stuff onto the real world?
Yeah, basically like you know, what the current Meta Quest 2 does with, like, you know, you step outside of the circle and you get the little black and white crappy view of the world. The current rumors on the Apple thing are that it's going to have much better cameras to the outside world, possibly even that goofy sounding thing that it shows your face on a screen to the outside world.
I hope that's wrong. That reminds me of some terrifying things from the peripheral TV series. Now showing on Amazon Prime. It's pretty good. You should check it out. Yeah, I can't imagine that not looking horrifying, but okay.
Yeah, but we'll see. Anyway, but you know, if that's the direction they're going, if they do a really great job of that, maybe there would be a decent amount of utility there, but that's not... I don't think this is going to be the kind of thing you're going to see people like walking around on the street wearing this thing. It's probably more going to be, you know, you might play with it in the office or, you know, at home sometime, but... You know, if they do a really good job of that kind of, you know, mixed reality before they can get to truly AR type like glasses, maybe that'll be really great in some way that I'm not thinking of and won't be super creepy and weird and uncomfortable and with the short battery life. But again, I look at these rumors so far and it just does not sound like a product that excites me at all. And so again, I hope I'm wrong. It's not to say that Apple can't do this because they have a lot of resources and a lot of smart people. and they tend to mostly do successful things. So I'm sure if they really put their mind to it, they can do it. But I wonder what exactly they're doing here. Like what and is this going to be good enough and successful enough to be worth all of this effort? And I don't know the answer to that yet. We have to see the product and see how it sells. But none of this sounds very exciting to me. So maybe we'll just be very pleasantly surprised, or maybe they haven't thought of something that we can't think of. Maybe they haven't broken out of the limited imaginations we have. And maybe it's just going to be a kind of okay product that doesn't go very far. I don't know. We'll find out eventually. But frankly, I'm so excited about their other products that I worry this might just be a big distraction.
Yeah, I've been throwing links into the chat room with a little L modifier so they show up in case he's linked list to things that I've posted on my blog in the past about these topics. One of them was the article I wrote entitled Antacid Tablet, which was throwing cold water on all the fantastical rumors about the iPad before it was released. And I'll take my annual victory lap for being right about that. But the other one was like, to your question about like, why are they building this AR headset now, if it's got to be this big bulky thing and, we're not quite at the point where we have the glasses or whatever. The article I wrote, back in 2013, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow.
Another song.
Yeah. You don't get to the glasses without doing all the hard work of the steps in between. And kind of like how we always talked about how it's important for Apple to do like their reality kit and the LiDAR sensor on the iPad and the AR, VR apps with, placing furniture in your house, how important it is for Apple to do that, even though it seems like it's a silly thing and they do those AR table demos and we all laugh at them or whatever, because what they're doing is they're developing the technology that will be needed for, the day when we get those glasses, right? You can't just wait, we're not going to look into this field until the glasses are ready, because then someone else will come and eat your lunch. So similarly, I think it is important for Apple to do the work to make a, Oculus, Quest, Valve Index style AR, VR headset thingy, more or less at the current level of technology, but a little bit better. Even if it is not a particularly successful product, because if they want to be a player in the space, you can't just wait around forever. The article that I posted was that people were complaining at the time about the slimming edge of the 5K iMac, because they took out the optical drive to make the edge of the 5K iMac slim. And they were like, why the hell are they making the edge of the iMac slim? Who cares how slim it is, right? Or like the iPhone 5 was too skinny. It's like, my phone didn't need to be that skinny. Why do you keep making it skinnier? And the analogy I made for the phone was like, yeah, but what if I told you it was as thin as a credit card? Then when you dropped your phone on the ground like Hazy, it wouldn't break because it would just flutter to the ground like a little credit card type thing, right? You're never going to get to that type of, fantasy clear phone that you see in sci-fi shows that is light and durable and, much, much sturdier than an aluminum glass thing that we have now or whatever. And for the iMac, I would say you don't get to the current 24-inch iMac that's practically the thickness of a phone if you don't spend years and years and years making your desktop computer thinner for reasons that people don't understand. Again, I'm not advocating for making stupid computers. I rail against that all the time. I'm just saying that like, you can't just make a big fat computer for decades and then you have your next computer be as thick as a 24-inch iMac. Like the expertise you build learning how to make skinny things pays off. And similarly, making headsets. Hopefully this one will be a little bit slimmer, a little bit lighter than existing products, have better specs, be more responsive, have more power, have better battery life, like all the things, right? And still, it might be the Apple Watch Series 0 of headsets, where people are like, it wasn't that great. It was way too slow. There was no good applications for it. The games on it were silly, whatever. But if you ever want Apple to make those glasses that let you walk around the city street, seeing Apple Map projecting everything in all directions and being able to look at messages and see people's names floating over their head and all that other good stuff that we want to happen, you don't get there unless you do all the work leading up to it. And by the way, you can't do all that work internally and never ship a product. So I'm already kind of like preemptively giving Apple a pass on this thing, that even if it is a massive flop, Apple needs to do this. In a way, they don't need to do a car, because I feel like this is up Apple's alley. If and when the technology gets to the point where we can all have, information displayed on our eyeballs in a way that is unobtrusive and lightweight, like with glasses or in the distant, distant future, magical contact lenses or whatever, that's where Apple should be. That's right up their alley. That's what they've always been doing. Personal computers, computing devices that you use yourself, right? Maybe less so with the car, but whatever. And so I do want to see them trying here, and I do want to see them ship something. And if this ends up being, you know, I was going to say the original HomePod, then, you know, go back to the drawing board and come out maybe not with the Apple VR goggles 1.5, but who knows? This year, apparently we'll find out.
You know, I can't help but wonder, what has Apple already said to us about this device without us realizing it? And the canonical example of this is auto layout before they switch to more than one screen size. You know, they kind of choreographed that switch by saying, hey, developers, what if we made this system that was a pain in the ass, but what if we made this system that would let you kind of dynamically adjust to different screen sizes and layouts and whatnot with magic? And, you know, they did this for a year or two. And then finally we got, what was it, the iPhone 4, the first iPhone that had a different sized screen. And obviously the clear example of how they're potentially choreographing this headset is all the AR stuff they've been doing recently. And I don't know enough about AR or VR or any or 3D programming or any of this stuff in order to be able to theorize where they're going. But I wonder if somebody, you know, more knowledgeable than I might be able to put together, you know, based on what these APIs are doing and the direction these APIs are going, what does this indicate to us? You know, I can't help but wonder if, you know, James Thompson, who spent an inordinate amount of time doing all sorts of interesting, and I say that genuinely, interesting and sometimes silly, but definitely interesting work in AR and VR. Well, maybe not VR, but like in AR and in 3D space and stuff like that. And like Carrot Weather's AR mode, which I've used like twice, but it's still a thing. What are these APIs telling us about the future? And all too often, we don't put it together until it was too late. I think in the auto layout example, I think we all kind of had a feeling where that was going. But a lot of times we'll look at it after the fact and go, oh, like a lot of the changes, I can't think of specific examples, but a lot of the changes that were in, that it turned out were to support Swift DSLs like Swift UI. What we didn't really know where that was going at first. I didn't think maybe my memory is bad. And then once Swift UI landed, we're like, oh, that's what that was about. And maybe one of you guys can kind of theorize about this. I don't think I'm the person to do it, but I can't help but wonder if we look at the changes and the new things introduced over the last several years, particularly around AR, you know, what does that tell us about the future?
I don't think they were particularly secretive about that, though, because like all the AR stuff we see, it's right there out in the open, and we've been developing it for years. What we were always asking is like, why the hell would I want to do that on my phone? Why do I need a LiDAR sensor on my iPad? And it's like, oh, well, if you wanted to change your paint color and interior decoration, and you can hold your iPad around and scan your room, and then you can use the IKEA app to drop furniture in, or you can tap on your walls and change the color, and then like, and it all makes sense. Like, yeah, I guess. And you know, you can use this to measure. Remember the measure tool? Oh, you're using mm-hmm. to measure mm-hmm. how is it accurate? Well, you know, kind of, not really as accurate as using a tape measure, but it's a fun thing to do. And like, you could always see what they're doing. Oh, the new AR thing, like we have better 3D rendering and it's better about detecting objects and things won't clip and overlap. And here you can remember putting the new Mac Pro on the table. They have the 3D model. Mm-hmm. It's right out there in front of us. The APIs for it, what you can use it for. But it's like, we'd always be looking at that and saying, okay, this is cool. I like that you're making this technology better. Every time at WWDC, you have new sessions, how you're making it better. And all of us were just saying, but we know all this is for when we strap something to our head, when we put something into our eyeballs, when we have a stereo image, one image in the left eye, one image in the right eye that allows us to have a 3D view of things. And like we know. And so we're waiting for this product to come out. And the questions about the product are things that I think that we haven't had hints of, like, for example, what is the UI? Unless Stage Manager is the hint. Lots of people read into that. Like, oh, Stage Manager is exactly what the UI is going to look like. And here's the problem with that prediction. It's almost impossible for that prediction to be wrong, because they're like, if there's literally any like computer window floating on an angle, they're going to say, see, it's just like Stage Manager. Even if they share no code, if the teams didn't know about each other, if they were in different parts of the world, right? Everyone will say, it's just like Stage Manager. I can tell you right now, there will be an ability to see essentially a screen that is not square with your eyeballs. And so if you wanted to predict, is it going to be like Stage Manager? Yeah, there's going to be a screen that's floating off to the side that's not square with your eyeballs. But it doesn't mean it's the same as Stage Manager. Anyway, it might literally be called Stage Manager. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, we can kind of see what they'll do. But what we haven't seen is, like, what is the UI? What is the equivalent of Springboard? How do you launch apps? How do you find apps? How do you interact with it? How do you enter text? Like all the, there's possibilities when you look at the competing products and how they do it, but we don't have answers to that because that's the stuff they don't have to release. But what they are releasing and what we do see is, how do you project objects into real space or metal, their 3D API? What does that support? All, you know, like we see that. We see the GPUs. We see their shader technology. We see their rendering pipelines. We see their sensor technologies with the cameras and the LiDAR. That's all out in the open for us to see because they ship products. They ship products and people ship apps and we can get to use it. But every time we use it, we think this is great and all, but it really needs to be in a headset. And so when the headset comes out, we're going to be like, oh, no, finally it's in a headset. And then we have more complaints, which is like, well, I don't want to spend $1,500 on a thing that I'm not sure what I would use it for.
Think we're good? Are we going to do some Ask High Future, Mark? Are we going to do some Ask ATP?
I think that's the show. Yeah.
All right. That's what I thought, too. Just making sure.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Green Chef, Trade Coffee, and Squarespace. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. We will talk to you next week.
We have a post show.
Let me see if
I have anything in particular.
Just watch Brian Day Gilbert videos. Surprised you weren't.
What?
No,
John, you just muted yourself in the middle of a sentence.
I did accidentally. Sorry. Anyway, Brian David Gilbert. He's funny. Go find his videos on YouTube.
What's the?
He's the guy with the healthcare technology overview.
Oh, all right.
He's got a lot of good videos.
What? Not trying to be funny. What sort of stuff does he cover typically?
He's I think he used to work at Polygon. He's a video game type guy, so he talks about video game stuff. It's kind of, you know, the humor that you see in that video. That's his style of humor, and he applies it to all subjects, so it's fun. You know, it's not an educational YouTube channel. Let's say it's a humor channel.
That's fair. Fair enough. I don't think I have any other interesting post show.
What else we got? That's not interesting enough. We got to do something else. Let's see. I already told you about my hose quick connect fittings.
Uh-huh. Did you get any new equipment with that, or is it still just status quo?
No,
it's already our setup.
Yeah, it's already all clipped on everywhere. I'm trying to figure out what to do with my iPad.
What do you mean by that?
Like in general. Like, you know, I bought an iPad for like stage manager testing with my app. That turned out not to really be much of a thing.
You should have sold it to me so I could have given it to my son, but you turned me down.
I'm never
and now you don't know what to do with it again.
Yeah, I'm back to not knowing what to do with it.
Just go back in time and sell it to me.
Easy.
Because I bought a brand new M2 one. It was way more expensive.
I tried once again using the iPad for some productivity roles and, you know, just doing simple things, email, notes, you know, basic things like that. And it just frustrates me every time. Mm-hmm. Like,
are you using
I had to jump between the physical keyboard? No, because of iPad OS. Like, the keyboard's fine, but it's just like, you know, I had to like jump between a couple of like, so I had, I started this yesterday. I had a mail message open that I was composing. I wanted to refer to an attachment in a different mail message. Now, you can actually do this now. This, you know, this wasn't always the case with iPadOS, but nowadays you can do that. You like, you know, push the little compose window down, and it goes into the little ghost lineup of lost windows that every app has somewhere hidden, like that you. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, how do you get back to that window? Well, you, as far as I know, you have to like tap the mail icon in the dock, so bring up the dock first, then tap the mail icon, then it brings up a little hovery ghost lineup, and then you pick it from there. And it's and I was, you know, doing that, switching between that and like a notes window, and trying to view this attachment so I could comment on it. And it was like, it was so cumbersome. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna go do this on a Mac where I can do it in 2 seconds super easily.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to solve the puzzle of how to subdivide your screen and how to find the ghost windows.
And
I know exactly
like
what you're talking about.
Subdivide it. Like when you're done, how do you close all these ghost windows?
Yeah,
like it's everything about it, just like.
And even within the realm of like the main multitasking thing that I use on the iPad, because my use case is very simple, is I use Slide Over a lot, just because it's mostly the case where I have one big thing that I'm doing, which is, let's be honest, probably watching a YouTube video or a TV show. And then in Slide Over, I have a bunch of other crap, like, you know, reading Twitter or Mastodon or looking at a Slack thing or whatever, right? And so I know how all of those modes work. I know how to get things in and out of Slideover. I know how to switch between them. I know how to move them from one side to the other. I know how to bring them full screen and move them back. Like within the realm of the small corner of functionality I want, I know how to do it. But then on top of that, apps have bugs. Slack, for instance, when it's in Slideover, if you want to type something, very often you can't hit the send button because the keyboard slides up over the send button. Like, you can't get to it. The only way to send that message is to put Slack into full screen because it's something about the layout of the thing is wrong. Like, they're measuring, they don't know where the keyboard is. They're measuring it wrong. And there's physically no way without an attached hardware keyboard, which I don't have, to hit send on the message you want. So you have to bring it into full screen, hit send, and then put it back into Slido. Bugs like that would not be tolerable in a Mac app. Imagine if, like, an Apple Mail, that when you opened a new message to compose it, you couldn't send it until you put the window into full screen. That would not be an acceptable shipping bug, but on common applications like Slack, basic functionality does not work in Slideover. Is it an OS bug? Is it a Slack bug? I don't know whose fault it is, but it's unacceptable, I say.
I just, like, every time I have tried to find a role for the iPad in my life, I either failed immediately or I have failed eventually. It's either I it works for a while and then all the limitations irritate me, or like my needs change or my priorities change and it goes away, and I hear from all the people who use and love iPads all the time, including the rest of my family, and I see how much everyone else uses them, and for the stuff I want to and have to do, I have just failed so hard, so consistently at making this device and this device family a routine part of my life. And I almost feel like I'm failing as an Apple nerd to find a use for all of their products. You know, like I really should be using an iPad on a regular basis, but like there have been long spans, month-long spans, where I haven't even had my own iPad. You know, oftentimes, like, it's because, like, oh, my kid's iPad broke, so I traded in mine for a few weeks while I got his fixed or whatever. Like, there have been long spans where I just haven't had one, and it's never really been a problem with a very few occasional exceptions. Like, oh, there's now a new iPad with a hardware capability I have to test for my app. That's about it. And I think Stage Manager was the first one of those in maybe 5 years. Like, so it's, like, and I just... Like, I understand that because I'm a human being, I don't need to find a use for every single one of Apple's products. I know that, academically speaking. But as an Apple nerd and a technology enthusiast and a person who, you know, makes a big part of my living from talking about as many Apple products as we can, I feel like I should probably find a use for this device in my life. But what is it?
You need to watch more YouTube. You need to watch more TV. You need to watch more movies in bed. Like, I mean, that's literally the main use of my thing. My iPad is on my nightstand next to my bed. I use it to watch YouTube, television, and movies in bed while I read other parts of the internet. That's what I use it for.
Wait, like, whoa, 99% whoa, hold of the on. Time. It's playing TV show on your lap while you're browsing, like on a different device, like on your phone or something?
No, it's the only thing on my lap. It's my iPad. It's in a little stand. It's propped up. I'm looking at it, and I'm watching either a YouTube video, a movie, or a television show before I go to bed. And then I'm saying I slide over things Mastodon and Twitter and Slack if the thing I'm watching is boring.
I don't know.
It's a two-screen experience with one screen.
But, like, I mean, even, like, YouTube is better on a laptop than it is on
No, it's not. The iPad is the best device for YouTube. Phone is probably best for TikTok, vertical and all. But to the extent that anybody should be using TikTok, but YouTube, iPad, they go together like peas and carrots.
I don't know. And by the way, the app that I usually would watch in bed, you know, before going to bed, is TikTok. So that, you know, that's probably not going to work very well on the iPad.
That's a phone thing, but I can encourage you to maybe, you know, check out some of those YouTube channels you subscribe to. Maybe they'll be more interesting and educational. If you're interested in seeing someone rebuild one of those hydrogen-powered V12s from those BMWs, that's what I was watching earlier today. He's got the whole bottom end of the engine reassembled. He's just waiting for the heads to come back from being ported in Poland. You can tune right into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now, all I see when Marco... I go to YouTube is like you know, people's expressions of surprise or confusion with their exaggerated faces.
Stop looking at the thumbnails.
A big headline that sounds really sensational, and then like holding up a diagonal Apple product. Like that's, and there's like 17, like I remember like when, I think, was it yesterday that all the HomePod YouTube reviews came out? I was looking at probably like the Mac Rumors, you know, page listing them all, and they had embedded like 5 or 6 or 9 different YouTube videos all in a row. Like, here's all the reviews. And you look down and you look at all the thumbnails and they all look exactly the same. Like, they're all different people on different channels, but it's like, okay, I can see the formula clear as day, and this is all YouTube looks like when I see it, and I don't like that. It just, it turns me off so much that all of these people who are otherwise, you know, smart people who I respect, and for most of them, or if not all of them, but to see them all stoop to this crappy formula, it just really turns me off.
Well, I can tell you that M539 Restorations does not have thumbnails like that. So again, if you want to watch a BMW's engine being slowly rebuilt over the course of a month, that's the channel for you.
Yeah,
what it's worth, Marco, I enjoy using my iPad when I'm on the couch, you know, so I'm multitasking, you know, two screening, etc. I think that's a really good time for it. Now, you could absolutely use your phone. I'm not saying this is required. You know, an iPad isn't required for this, but I do like it for that a lot. I also really, really like it if I'm a passenger in a car for a journey, you know, that's relatively long. So if I'm going to be in the car for like an hour and Aaron's driving, it's a great device for that. And why is that, Marco? Because guess what? It has a cellular modem. if only I could pay Apple an obscene amount of money to include one of those in a MacBook Pro. Gosh, that would be amazing. Have we ever talked about that? I feel like we should talk about that sometime. But anyway, I really do enjoy it for those kinds of things. And I really do, for the most part, like using it. And I know this is such a tired thing to say, but I like using it for consumption. If I am not at my desk and I want to catch up on the things that I think we're going to talk about tonight on ATP, then I'll oftentimes grab my iPad, because if I'm just reading stuff, it's great for that. Now, if I'm sitting down to add things to the show notes, oh no, put me in front of a Mac every day, anytime, because not only is doing like multiple things on the iPad a pain in the butt, as you two have both described, but the Google apps on the iPad, in my personal opinion, are straight trash and are terrible. And so because of that, if I'm adding stuff to the show notes, I will absolutely be doing that on a Mac. But if I'm just consuming the things in the show notes, if I'm catching up on the videos that you and John have put in or the links that you and John have put in, I can absolutely do that on the iPad and it's no problem. And it's a much more, even with the big heavy keyboard, it is a pretty convenient thing to carry, even with the pencil on the side of it that I don't even use that often. I still find it far more convenient to carry that around than I do a laptop. And the battery life, although now with the M1 laptops and M2 laptops, battery life isn't really an issue anymore either. But the battery life on the iPad is great, even with the cellular modem on. So I'm not saying you're wrong, for the record. I think I'm not creating uses for it necessarily, but I am finding uses for the iPad where I have other devices that would work almost as well. So you're not really wrong or missing out or anything like that. But I do think if you are the kind of person to two screen, you know, in the living room, or if you wanted to be out and about and you know, if, like, say on the boat to or from the mainland, I can imagine, assuming you have cellular service there, which I presume you do, that'd be a perfect time for an iPad. If you're just goofing off on the boat and you just want to, you know, spend however long that boat trip is, like half an hour, just goofing off. That's perfect for an iPad, assuming you have cellular.
I see. I usually just use the phone for that.
And that's not unreasonable. It's not unreasonable at all. But if you have it, if you have one to use, you might as well use the iPad.
I mean, if you're watching, like, that's what I was saying, watching video, like TikTok or something small like that. But if you're watching a television show or movie, which I know you're not that into, a bigger screen is better. You know, and if you're watching someone rebuild an engine and you want to see the details, it's too small on your phone. You can't see it. Like, it's too zoomed out. Even if it's like 4K, everything's tiny, right? So the iPad is a bigger screen. Not so big that it's unwieldy, but, you know, same thing with like on a tray table, on, you know, taking a flight. iPad is a better thing to watch a movie on than watching a movie on your phone, right? And even I, so like I have the big phone because I do watch YouTube videos on my phone, plenty of times, right? But in the winding down, going to bed thing, I use the iPad for that because it is a better device for that. And also it stands up on its own. It has a little, you know, I turn the little smart cover around to make the little triangle and I don't have to hold it up at all. Whereas my phone, I would have to be holding, right? And when I'm going off to bed, I don't want to have to hold it up. So, and would a laptop be better? There's no way I would keep a laptop next to my bed. I don't need the keyboard. It's big and unwieldy. I don't need that complexity. So that's the place the iPad fits in my life. I would be very sad without it. Whereas on the other hand, I haven't worn an Apple Watch in ages, and I don't spend any of my time thinking about how I can fit an Apple Watch into my life. But I still have my Apple Watch, although at this point it's probably dead. Like, it's been in the drawer for so long. Like, they always get to the point where they're so drained that they can't even charge anymore. I should check that out sometime.
Yeah, is it still the first generation one?
Series Zero. Yeah. My wife has the current watch. I'm living vicariously through her watch use to be up on what it's like to have a watch, because she gets a new one very frequently, uses it every single day. You know, I see her use it. I see her send messages to and from it and, you know, whatever. So I feel like I'm up on the watch, even though I'm not wearing one, just because I'm not a watch person.
Titles. Almost Walrus Lever is pretty good. Level is pretty good. I Want to Be Twice as Thick. I love a double entendre, but I know we usually try to avoid that. Bananas ingestion system. What was that about?
You were talking about your photo ingestion system, but it sounds much more fun. Mm-hmm. Did you just not
that
know
is,
that?
That is pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good.
Which I do like that a lot. That's one of my favorite titles.
That is very good.
Let me see what else. We have a bunch of others that are like okay, but I think we have a few that are decently good. So
HomePod 1.5 isn't bad.
I like that. Yeah. I also like Old Dumb Power.
I guess you should have a HomePod title for when Marco actually gets his and talks about them.
Yeah, hopefully next week. Hopefully there's not much more to say on them, but yeah, we'll find out.
Well, I mean, you'll have to listen to it and see how it is. What you need to do for when you get yours is compare your old HomePods to your new one.
Yes, and like, I'm prepared to do that side by side.
To be your opinion of is the sound just as good? Is it better? Is it worse, but you don't care? Like, that's what people need to know. And then the responsiveness, which is the thing that, again, nobody seemed to test or care about, but I feel like is a major sticking point of the old one. And potentially something better in the new one.
Yeah.
I also liked I Did My Normal Bake Off, which maybe isn't the best title, but what it was referring to was hilarious. Let's see. We'll All Be Dead. That's very morose. Increment of Betterness isn't bad. That's a very ATP title. And I think my favorite is probably Bananas Ingestion System.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
All right, we're going to go with that.
All right, that was pretty obscure, but it's a good title.
All right, it's going in. What is it that takes so damn long when I hit create new episode? You've told me before, but I don't remember.
It's actually updating feeds. It's like It rewrites the six different feed variants or whatever. It rewrites them all.
Fair enough. All right. I have hit save.
No one put in, I was surprised no one put in, what was it, C to A to C? I know there's a C to C title, but there's no C to A to C, like the weird dongle chain.
No, there is. The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, fifth one down, 4 votes.
No, that's C to C. Oh, it's because of lowercase the A. Yep. Okay. You could just be case preserving, Casey.
If you would like.
It'd be smart. It'd be case preserving unless they're one of those people type in all lowercase and then you punish them by running it through title case.
I mean, I could do that, but I'd rather just run it all through
title case. But the question is, did that person write it with correct capitalization or did they write it all
probably.
Lowercase?
I bet they did. I bet they did. John, this is all open sourced. I encourage you to make a pull request.
Yeah, someone's sending me pull requests for one of my libraries now. It's like going around in circles for this one person for a library that I haven't done any development on in a decade.
That's why I don't open source much anymore.
Yeah, no, it's just if there's one thing I can get across to people, if you send a pull request, you have to include tests and documentation. Like, I'm not going to write that for you anymore. I used to do that for people. If they sent a patch, I would be like, okay, I'll write the tests for it. I'll update the docs. But now, I'm sorry. If you're sending me, it's a one-line patch. Great. Where's the test? Where's the update to the documentation? If you've made a functional change that changes something, or you added a feature, or you added a method, you got to write docs for it. What is this? Not Apple. And then where are the tests? You. Like, the worst part is I can tell they don't even run the existing tests. It's like, hey, you sent a patch. It breaks tests. Like, you broke it. Like, just anyway, going back and forth with somebody. And I just posted a message that says, please remember to add docs and tests.
And then they ignored it.
Yeah. Everybody, it's not optional.
Title.
Optional at Apple, not optional in my open source library from 25 years ago. Nice. Sorry. Gotta have tests.
All right. Goodbye, live people. I'm ready for bed.
Yeah, let's do it. Bye, live people. Thanks for listening. This is a good one. Yeah, let's go to bed. All right. See you.